STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Who ate my chicken?
Hello, my friends. Greg Kokel here. Glad to be with you today on Stand to Reason. And I'm looking forward to chatting with you here. Lines are beginning to light up. That's a good sign. On anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion that's on your mind, my goal, of course, to stand to reason for classical Christianity, classical Christian values, demonstrating that the worldview of Jesus of Nazareth, commonly known as Christianity, can stand to reason, can compete in the marketplace of ideas. And so that's what I hope to show. My goal here is to give you peace of my mind, and that's all I ask of you. All right? So if you're inclined to give a call and want to chat with me, you're welcome to do so. You have to call during the live show, which is on Tuesday nights from 3 until 7. And the number there is 855-243-9975. Nice to see. Did I say it wrong? 4 until 7. See, nice to see you back, Tom. We missed you the last couple of weeks. Tom had a baby. Well, his wife had a baby, and that means they were both out of commission because they got lots of babies over there. But now he's on board just in time to remind me that I got my numbers wrong again. 4 until 7. Yeah, 3 hours is plenty. Thank you, Thomas. 4 until 7, Los Angeles time. So do your numbers and give us a call on Tuesday if you'd like to chat with me about anything on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Two and a half weeks ago now, I was in Poland doing some work there with a fabulous group of people. I talked about that in the past, but I wanted to relate a conversation to you that I had during one of my classes. I think I was teaching on tactics. And in this particular event, they want the presenters to leave lots of opportunity for interactive discussion towards the end of each hour, basically. So 15, 20 minutes is given to interaction. And you never know what's going to happen, what kind of issues are going to come up. Even though I'm making my case, training regarding maneuvering tactically in conversations, people can bring up all kinds of different things. And in this particular conversation, remember, I'm speaking for the most part with Europeans who are even more deeply influenced by a naturalistic, materialistic way of thinking than we are in the States. And when I say even more deeply influenced, I'm talking about Christians as well. Indeed, even myself, I would say, being someone raised in Western civilization that has a deeply materialistic bias, that is a bias towards believing in physical things, but not believing characteristically as a culture in non-physical things. Now, I need to qualify that. Materialism is the philosophy of the academic elite. In our country, most people are not materialists. We know better than that. We know that non-material things exist, and there are a whole host of these things, including souls and God and spirits of different types and ideas and sensations and thoughts and the beliefs, acts of will. These are all immaterial realities that we experience every day. What I mean to say is, even though I, along with many others, affirm the existence of these things as part of our worldview, we are still influenced by our materialistic culture, which means it's harder for, I think, Americans to trust God to intervene in prayer for a healing than it is for Christians, say, in India or Thailand or somewhere like that, some third world or, shall we say, developing world country where there is a much richer cultural commitment to the existence of immaterial realities. They're more culturally fit for believing those kinds of things than we are. And so, not surprisingly then, when I'm in Poland working with Christian leaders from Western Europe, helping to train them, that they are going to be pushing back sometimes impulsively with materialistic convictions, even though they are not, strictly speaking, materialists. And this happened when somehow in conversation the issue of abortion came up. And again, I wish I could remember what the lead-in was, but I began to get pushback from this conferee in a way that surprised me a bit, because the pushback, as I'll describe it in a few minutes, regarding my defense of the pro-life view against abortion entails, of course, my defense that abortion is wrong because it takes the life of an innocent human being without proper justification, and virtually no justification for abortion is adequate. Whatever justification is not adequate to kill a two-year-old is not adequate to kill a child inside the womb, in my view. But, of course, this, I guess, presumes a certain understanding of what it means to be human. Now, I trade on this way of arguing regarding the abortion question because I think most people, at least when they're not trying to defend their own philosophical turf and their own views about abortion, if they're just simply, if the question is simply put to them, do you think it's wrong to kill innocent human beings and then offer some of the reasons that people give for abortion, I think most people are going to say, yes, that's wrong. And so I'm trading on that natural instinct, and I'm just trying to show that there is really no substantive difference, no morally relevant difference between a newborn or a two-year-old and one that is not yet born, but developing in the womb. And anyway, so it's this line of thinking that I'm prosecuting here, or trying to lay out quickly in response so the students can get a sense of where I'm going. Those of you familiar with Standard Reasons material on the abortion question, you know how this works. What is the unborn is the basic question. And if the unborn is a human being, then no justification for abortion is adequate. If it's not a human being, no justification is necessary. But if the unborn turns out to be a human being, well, then no justification, none that are normally given for elective abortion, seems to be adequate because we don't kill innocent human beings because we have freedom of choice or privacy or any of those other things. Anyway, that's the basic line I was offering, line of reasoning, that is, not line of baloney, but line of reasoning that I was offering, and somebody began to push back almost immediately. I mean, they almost came out of their chair raising their hand. And I knew as I'm listening, I was surprised to hear this because I know the person was a deeply committed Christian, but I knew that what I was hearing was the physicalist way of viewing these things. And I never expected to hear that from a thoughtful Christian. And in fact, at first I thought he was just playing the other side, or at least I was tempted to think that. But after a few moments, I realized he was so vigorous about this that he was really advancing his own views. What I had said was that there is something growing inside of a pregnant woman. And we know the pregnant woman, the thing inside the pregnant woman, is not the pregnant woman. That is, the thing growing is not her. It's inside her, but it's not the same as her. And how do we know that? Because DNA analysis demonstrates that there is a different, unique fingerprint of that organism from the mother. Each have human DNA, so we know the thing growing is human, but their DNA is distinct from each other, so we know it's not the mother's body. It's some other body, human body, growing inside of mom. And that's the basic line there. So we know that the thing that is alive, it's growing, and the thing that's alive is human, and the human thing that's alive inside mom is not mom. Now, this is just straight ahead science. But when I mentioned the DNA blueprint and fingerprint, immediately I got pushback from this student. When I say student, I don't mean like a teenager. He's an adult, but he was a student here at the conference. And he said he took exception with me identifying DNA with the human being because DNA is simply the blueprint, and it's not the building. Mr. Coakley, you're making a mistake. you're mistaking the blueprint for the building. Then he pointed out that the zygote and embryo stages were just like the early stages of a building. So you lay the foundation, then you put the framing up, and then you put the walls on, you do the electrical, and on you go until you finally get the building. Before that, it's not the building. It is, it is the building of the building. All right? But the building of the building does not result in a building until the building is completed. Keep your verbs and nouns separate there, or else you'll get confused. Now, at this point, I pointed out that the metaphor he was using was not parallel with reality. And a lot of times, metaphors that people use or illustrations or whatever, though may be helpful for clarifying some things, at other points, they lose their value because they cease to be parallel in appropriate ways with the thing that you're describing. And I said, because unlike a merely physical thing, living beings are wholly themselves from the outset. And when you think of a building does not become a building just when you lay a foundation. It doesn't become a building, it seems, and even when you put the walls up. Because a building is not a building until all the parts are there to make the whole. But in the case of a living thing is a whole thing the moment it comes into existence, and it doesn't become something else. It is always itself completely, even though it goes through different stages of development. And so we could have zygote stage, we could have embryo stage, we can have newborn stage, we could have child stage, we could have adolescent stage, we could have young adult, we could have adult, we have middle age, we have... Notice that these are all stages of the development of the same thing. And really, even the demarcations of those stages are somewhat arbitrary. That is, we're calling this a zygote until a certain day of development, and after that we choose to call it an embryo. But nothing significant changes from the last day this human being in development is a zygote and the first day this human being in development is an embryo. It's just a continuum of transformation physically of the same thing. And this was the point that I was trying to get him to see. I wasn't asserting that the DNA was the human being. I was trying to explain that we know that the thing, the whole living thing inside mom, is a human thing distinct from mom in virtue of the DNA marker. I wasn't equating the DNA, that is the blueprint, with the building. I was making the point that if you want to use the metaphor building to describe the whole human being in the womb, it is the DNA that identifies what kind of building it is. That would be a human building. But see, he was having none of this. He kept pushing back on this. And so, all right, in Columbo style, since I was teaching on tactics, I asked them this question. Were you ever an unborn child? Now, this is a very important question. Were you ever an unborn child? And you see what I'm getting at here. I'm trying to get at the sense of unity through time that living things have, even though there is change in the physical appearance. Even though you weren't big like you are now, you presumably were small then. I mean, I guess I'm kind of answering my question here for him, but was that you in your mother's womb? And he first asked for clarification. What do you mean by that? Now, I think he did that because this is a class on tactics, and I just taught him to ask that. But there wasn't the slightest bit of ambiguity in my question. Nice try. Doesn't apply here. You know what I mean. Were you ever the child your mother carried whose name, who was given your name on the day that you count as your birthday? Was that you? Was that someone else? Was that a potential you? Was that a possible you? or was that you? Now, he balked at this point because he said, well, the self consists of self-consciousness, and he was not conscious of himself as a self when he was born. He wasn't capable of having memories at that time. Therefore, he did not exist. I'm not kidding you. This is what he said. And of course, then it wasn't him in the womb. And so the simple answer to the question, were you ever an unborn child, is no. To which I responded, that's ridiculous. Now, you might be thinking, well, that doesn't sound like a Columbo question to me. You're right. Sometimes, and I wasn't being mean, I was just, sometimes you just have to say the obvious thing that's not particularly clever. You got to be careful you're not mean about it. But I'm standing there in front of this group of people, students, and this man is saying ridiculous things. And sometimes you just got to say, the emperor has no clothes. That's ridiculous. And sometimes physicalists, or those that at least are thinking or talking like physicalists, are so taken with their mental machinations that they cannot see the nonsense of their words when they're still ringing in their own ears. I told them my first memory was when I was 2 years old. On my second birthday, I was in the driveway of Lester somebody in Antigo, Wisconsin. He was my dad's boss, backed out with the pickup truck, banged into me in the hip, broke my leg. My second birthday, my first memory. Who was it that bore my name before that first memory? Who was that running around for those first 2 years on his view? Who or what was in my mother's womb that was born on June 10th, 1950, and that who bore my name for 2 years until I became myself with my first memory? You see how silly that is. Look, completely physical things are assembled in parts, and they are only completed when all the parts are there in the right order. Keep in mind, by the way, that the whole notion of any physical thing being completed depends on a certain intention for those parts when they're assembled. If there is no intention, then you can never say they're completed. They're just in a different form. The notion of anything being whole or complete entails the notion of intention, it seems to me, of a purpose for that in which one puts the final piece, which simply means the last piece that is necessary for the intention for that thing to be fulfilled. Even with that kind of language, you can't avoid, even with physical things being completed, you can't avoid design language. But in any event, living things aren't like that. They're whole and complete selves throughout their entire existence. And regardless of the age or the form or the name that we give them at different stages, those are arbitrary distinctions, zygote, fetus, newborn, etc. These are not different things. These are different stages of development of the same thing. And as I mentioned, even the precise distinction of those stages is something we impose on them. They are not inherent to the living thing. Now, living things are fundamentally, metaphysically different from non-living things. They are not merely aggregations of physical parts. They are unified selves that remain themselves throughout the process of physical change, which, by the way, is ultimately going to be an argument for the soul, since nothing else can ground personal identity through physical change over time, certainly not memories. Your body's changing. I was challenged by a college student once in a Q&A at a university where I was speaking on a related topic, and he challenged my understanding of the soul and the existence. And I said, listen, how old are you? Or when were you born is what I asked. He gave me his birth date. I said, the body you have right now, is it the same body that you had when you were born on that birth date? No, it wasn't, obviously. Well, if you were born on your birth date and your body that you have now was not the same body you had then you are not your body, are you? Now, we had nothing to say to that because it's a very straightforward line of thinking. We are aware of the unity of ourselves over time, even though our physical body is changing. So what is it that is not changing that unifies our identity over physical change? It is our immaterial selves that turn out to be the only things that we're aware of every single waking moment of our lives. That's how obvious the existence of the soul is. And the gentleman mentioned something about twinning as like evidence against my view. It can't be a human being there because it can twin. Well, that doesn't prove anything. All it proves is that a genuine human being can twin, can divide and become two separate human beings. What's the problem there? In any event, afterwards, I did talk to some people. I wanted to get some feedback, partly because the conversation got a little bit, I don't know if intense is the right word, but it certainly was charged. I tried to keep my manners, and he did as well, though it was still charged. So I wanted to double check, did I do something wrong? I step out of bounds. I asked a couple of people. One person actually thought that I had set this whole thing up, that he was a plant. So I could use him as an example of the tactical approach because the person in the class who listened to the whole thing thought it was a great example of what I had been teaching, but it wasn't a plan. I followed my tactical game plan, but that was a real story, which shows how much we can be influenced by our cultural ethos, even when we have a worldview that dictates otherwise. Anyway, to your calls in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe to STR's monthly publications, Solid Ground and Greg's Mentoring Letter. Just go to str.org and click on the subscription button at the top of the page. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. We'll send you the bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, that Greg Kokel writes on an in-depth subject, free for a year. We'll also send you his bi-monthly mentoring letter that he writes on practical skills you need to be an ambassador for Christ. These are no ordinary newsletters. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ for free. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like why the Bible is reliable, evolution, abortion, timely issues so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador for Christ on key issues you will be challenged on. You can go to str.org, subscribe to the e-news to receive Solid Ground and the mentoring letter.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org. All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, giving you a piece of my mind, as I do every Tuesday from 4 till 7. Tom had to run that spot just to kind of correct the numbers to make sure nobody was confused. All right, great. Let's start taking calls. Here we have an anonymous caller from an anonymous location. Glad you called. I don't know, what do we call you, Bill or Phil?
You can call me Bill if you'd like.
All right, Bill. I'm glad you called. Thank you. Hi.
Thanks so much. Well, Greg, I want to just thank you so much for your ministry. I found out about you through the White Horse Inn, which is also played a huge part in my life.
And oh, great.
I just read Tactics last month, and it was a huge breath of fresh air to me personally, and I've been consuming a lot of the podcast, and it's just been very, very helpful.
Great.
I just can't thank you enough for what Stand to Reason is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I am a photographer, and I'm in the wedding industry,
mm-hmm.
and I love when you talk about not having to do more work than you have to do, but I find myself with inquiries of same-sex marriages,
mm-hmm.
wondering the best way to approach turning it down or saying that I'm unavailable, or just how do I feel like my hand is forced so quickly
mm-hmm.
on the situation with people that I don't know, with people that are calling me blind. And I've been able to, it's interesting, some people have called and I've already been booked, so I've been able to say I'm booked.
Mm-hmm.
Some people I've been able just to say I'm unavailable, and that's been fine.
Mm-hmm.
But just last month I was asked point blank, hey, I'm having my gay marriage, will you document it? And
mm-hmm.
I told him, I said, well, I don't personally agree with this, and therefore I don't think I'm the best fit for you, because I think that you should probably have someone mm-hmm. who supports this this celebration. It's not fair to you to pay me a lot of money to mm-hmm. not, and it's a very personal thing. And I can recommend some people to you who I think will be okay doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I hung up the phone. I had no idea if Twitter was going to explode, and all of a sudden I'm shut down, or just a huge market against me. And it's hard, too, because most of my clientele is very wealthy, very educated, very liberal. And even if it was just, you know, I know a lot of people are worried about, you know, will it force you to do it. I think by me just people knowing that I don't do it, I think
uh-huh.
it's going to be a huge mark against me.
Right.
And I also take great peace in what you said, that in what you have said, that we aren't assured persecution, and it's coming. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of this is me just needing to say, like, this is persecution versus being wise.
Right.
Hey, using tactics in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Bill, there's one little piece that I missed because you're breaking up just a little bit. So,
okay.
You said something about Twitter. So, you told the person that you don't think you're the best fit for them because of this is a celebration and you're not celebrating with them, basically. So, maybe it'd be better to find somebody that really was comfortable in that environment. And
correct.
Did you say then it went on Twitter?
No, I said I didn't know if I would hang up the phone and see this guy tweeting out that this company refuses to do this, which it is happening. I mean, I was fortunate in that he did not do that, but I know that my days are probably numbered for kind of staying below the surface on where I stand with this issue.
Uh-huh.
So I'll respect you so much, and I'm curious if there's any tactical way of engaging this question when your hand is forced so quickly with
mm-hmm.
people that you don't know in an issue that I would rather not be the issue that
right.
I'm fine by, but I apparently don't have a choice over this. So
you know what? Thank you for calling, first of all, Bill, and also for flattering me with your request that I would maybe be able to offer something. I have some thoughts that I want to give you, but as we're talking, I'm jotting some things down that you have said that I think are actually rather clever given what you're faced with, and maybe a combination of things might be helpful at this point. You said something about you put on the spot, okay, and then I'm wondering, the first thing that came to my mind when you said that is, gee, if you're put on the spot, you're put in an awkward position, and how can we sidestep this so that you get some breathing room, all right?
Yeah.
Secondly, you and I both know that there are going to be disingenuous callers who are going to be trying to trap you.
Yeah.
And they don't care about having your services. In fact, they may not even have any wedding, whatever, in mind. They are just putting this to you, and who knows if they're taping or whatever, and then they're going to try to squeeze you. And this happens by this group a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. So here, I'm just sometimes talking together about this generates something productive. And so here's the first thought that I have. When you get somebody to call you and say, will you do my same-sex ceremony or anything like that, the impulse is to say, now I've got to answer yes or no regarding the issue per se. But it strikes me you don't have to answer that. First, you could say, well, who are you and where you're from and what's your date and what church you're going to be at and what's the name of your pastor, and you like to get all of the relevant information down before you commit yourself. So you're asking questions now to gather information. And you could say at some point, I'm going to have to get back to you and talk to you later about this. So in your initial conversation, you can plan it so that you don't make any commitments of any kind, one way or another. You don't show your cards at all.
Okay.
Okay. All you have to say is, you know, I've got to, I need to follow up on this information and think about this. What if you just said that?
Isn't that just delaying the inevitable in a way?
No, not necessarily, and I'll tell you why. It's not inevitable in my mind that this person is going to call back. It's not inevitable.
Yeah.
Are you married?
Yes, I am married.
How many photographers did you contact before you? Well, you might be being in the business. You might have had just one in mind or something like that. But
yeah, I had a boss.
Okay, well, so but isn't it normal for people to make contacts with especially if they're cold calling?
Contact a couple
of different photographers and find the right fit. And people with looking for help in that kind of way are looking for a fit, right?
Right.
We did that when we got married. We met with the woman who took our pictures. We felt she understands what we're doing, what we're about, whatever. So let's just presume this is legitimate.
Yeah.
The other person just touching base with you. And what he gets from you, whoever gets from you, is a series of questions that are relevant to the issue and the statement you have to give it some thought.
Yeah.
Let me check up on these details. Thank you. Goodbye. Okay, now what you haven't said is whether you're going to do it or not going to do it. You haven't committed yourself at all philosophically with regards to the moral issues, and you haven't said you're going to call back.
Yeah.
Okay? But what you do have is relevant information. Now, it's possible for you now to check up on this relevant information. Like, for example, where are you registered for your wedding gifts? Why should that matter? Well, because I try to find out all I can about the people who are potential clients. Then you could find out whether this person's legit or not.
Yeah.
Now, if they aren't legit, then there's no reason to call them back. If they call you back and you say, I have no reason to believe that this is a legitimate request, so I'm not pursuing it any further, and that's the end of that conversation.
What if it is a legitimate request?
Okay. If it is a legitimate request and you delay it to another phone call, my suspicion is a whole bunch of these people are not going to call you back. So you're going to eliminate...
Am I putting it on them to call me back
in
that scenario?
Sure. Well, you say, you know, I'm just going to have to do a little bit of background checking or whatever, however you want to put it. Write it out.
Yeah.
Find a way to say it that sounds professional and somewhat innocuous but doesn't commit you.
Yeah.
You know, and some people might be thinking, well, see, you're kind of playing a little game here. And my response is, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
We are trying to figure out how to maneuver shrewdly in the circumstance without creating any liability and without trying to sidestep any difficulties for anybody. That's called blessed are the peacemakers, all right?
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with that at all, Bill. So that's the first thing I'd say. Figure out when you get a request like this, first ask a lot of information, like you're filling out a form. Name, dates, church, pastors, where you're registered. I just need these details. I can't commit yet, but I need all this information. I need to follow up on this information before I commit.
I think the hard thing, too, is sometimes like the person that called me was pretty straight to the point. Or do you have a problem documenting a gay wedding? Was there a question to me?
I need to ask some other questions. I need to ask some other questions first.
Yeah.
There, I mean, that's my role play right there. I need to have, I need to answer. I need to get some other information before I go into any of those details.
Yeah.
Okay. When is the wedding? Dot, dot, dot. What's your name, sir?
Yeah.
And your partner's name, first and last. You're writing it down. And you do this. In fact, you need to have a record of that. I mean, just archive it.
Yeah.
For legal reasons, who knows? You could say, look, I took all the information. I got it all here. You're doing due diligence. There's nothing wrong with you doing that. You can't be accused of anything untoward. Do you do that for all your people? Does it matter? Who cares? Anyway, maybe you'd want to start doing that for all your people. Maybe. I don't know.
Right.
But see, I'm trying to buy you some time. That's all.
Okay.
So here you buy yourself some time. All right? And then you just let it lie. If they call back, then you got to go into stage two on this one, right? And then you ask, tell me what you're looking for. And this is something you suggested to me indirectly. This is what I thought of when I heard you talking. Tell me, and I'm role-playing now, tell me what you're looking for in a photographer. Are you looking for somebody that understands what this means to you, that wants to celebrate it with you, that wants to capture your excitement? I don't know. What are you looking for? And then you can let them talk a little bit. You could feed some things. And then you may be at a position to say, you know what? I probably am not the person that can give you what you're looking for. And that's kind of what you told me.
Yeah.
I'm not the best fit.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm the... To be honest with you, you could say, I'm uncomfortable with these kinds of services. And if I'm uncomfortable with these kinds of services, I don't think I'm going to give you the best service. Mm. You're not going to get what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And so I have never had this thought before about these things, Bill, but your comments early on suggested this to me. I thought, well, that what Bill is saying is, that sounds good. This is a nice, do you really want me? The question isn't, do I want you?
Yeah, right. You're going to spend a lot of money for someone there's a lot of people out there that would be ecstatic about this.
Yes, but exactly. My heart's not going to be in this, all right? And if my heart's not in it, you're going to sense that I'm not celebrating with you, that I'm not on the page with you, that I'm not, you're just going to sense this. By the way, notice that nothing... There has not been any conversation about whether you will or won't do it.
Right.
And there hasn't been any conversation about anything that can... You're talking about your feelings, that's all.
Yeah.
And whether, given the feelings you have, and and at this point so far, you can't be fined for your feelings.
Yeah.
Now, who knows what's going to happen? You can't parody this stuff, you know. But if you... We're trying to find a way to ease you out of this and let them disqualify themselves if they can.
Right.
Okay, so that's what you're looking for. And I'm going to be really uncomfortable. And then, look, maybe they're just trying to snag you and say, will you do it or won't you?
Yeah.
Oh, are you asking me? Then maybe you'd say, are you asking me? Are you hiring me right now?
Yeah.
Is that what you're doing? Are you hiring me, or are you trying to box me in?
Right.
Okay. And that's when I think it's fair to start getting a little bit cagey with them and say, I'm not going to be boxed into this, okay? I'm asking you what you're looking for in a photographer.
Right.
Okay. I'm also telling you that all the things you described, man, I'm not comfortable with this at all. And so, therefore, my suspicion is you're not going to get what you want.
Yeah.
You want to hire me? Do you want to hire me? And put it that way. Again, who knows how successful you're going to be here, but this is a lot better than just saying,
Well, what's your thought about, because I live in a very liberal community as well. I do a lot of family sessions, and I'm really torn with maybe a same-sex family that has children that would approach me to do a family session. And how I would address that.
Yeah,
that really
I think you can address it the same way in principle.
Yeah.
I don't think that you should be obliged to ply your trade in a way that you're morally uncomfortable with. And one could imagine other circumstances we can contrive where, you know, just you say, you know, I don't want to mess with this. It just is my personal views. You can put it any way you want, but it's just my hang up, whatever. I'm just not comfortable with this. And I think if you say no because I have religious objections, if you imply that, you're going to get – this is – the courts are already weighing in on these kinds of things, and they're just not going to – at least some of them are not going to respect your conscience concerns.
Right.
So maybe – maybe
what's
if you
the best wording there?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what the best word. I'm just kind of shooting from the hip here now, and this is maybe what you can work with. And I'd suggest doing this thing, just playing out this. I'm really, really uncomfortable with this circumstance. There's a lot of circumstances that I might be uncomfortable with. This is one of them. And if I'm going to be uncomfortable with this, I'm not going to. I don't expect my work is going to satisfy you.
Right.
If you say I'm not going to do good work for you, they might say, well, see, you're choosing to do a lousy job because I'm gay. Well, that's not what you mean.
Right.
So this is why I think it would be good for you to try to write some of these little scripts out so they're handy and practice them kind of in your mind or however before you get there. And if you're anticipating how you might respond, then when it comes up, you can say, oh, okay, and your name and the web and here's information. I'm going to have to think about this. All right?
Yeah.
All right. Let me follow up on some of this data.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for your call.
Thanks, there you go. Greg.
Nothing. No, I was role playing. I wasn't saying.
Oh.
I was just role playing there. Sorry, I didn't want you to hang up. I want you to see how this might play out, and then you could say, "Well, wait, what's the problem?" I said, "Well, I have to check your data out. I don't know." And then you could say, "Well, I don't know if this is a legitimate request or not. I have to check all of that out first."
Right.
And so that's. Thank you very much for your call. There you go. Okay. Yeah. And then what I would do in that case is I would check that out.
Yeah.
And because if you check it out and you find out it's a phony or you could not verify the data, then you are fully within your rights when somebody calls again to say, you know what, I've tried to check this out. I didn't find any of this information. Therefore, I'm not interested in even talking about doing business. If they call back. If they don't call back, you're home free. If they do call back and it's legit, that's when you go into phase two. Okay, now what's phase three? I would say phase three, and this is where advice is cheap because it doesn't cost me to give you this advice, but it may cost you to carry this advice out. You have to survey your own conscience. And if your conscience before the Lord says, I do not think it's right for me to serve this kind of ceremony, and keep in, you know, the distinction between serving the person and serving the ceremony.
Yeah.
I'm sure that you don't care about taking a snapshot of somebody who has same-sex sexual attraction, taking their photo, but this is something different.
Yeah.
And so your animus is not against gays. Since you'd serve them individually or whatever, but your animus is against a celebration of something you think is wrong, participating in that, then I think you're on a more solid ground. Now, of course, at least the courts in New Mexico did not honor the distinction I just made, and rhetorically, the other side doesn't honor it at all. They seem to be constitutionally, intellectually incapable of seeing the distinction. They just want to cry bigot, you know, because they're bothered about this. But I'm just trying to think of a shrewd way to help you to step through this.
Yeah.
So you don't want push come to shove until push comes to shove. If you can dodge, if you can sidestep some way, then you do that.
If it ever comes to, it's all out there, this company is a bunch of bigots, that's a whole nother question, I'm assuming.
I don't know that you're going to be able to do anything about that. I don't think you're going to be able to do anything about that. You know the old saying that a lie gets halfway around the world before truth gets its boots on. People can say whatever they want in the public square, and you will never retrieve it. And that's just a sad fact of reality. And this is where, you know, your passage from Matthew chapter 5 comes into play, where Jesus says, blessed are you when all manner of people speak ill of you for the gospel's sake. Great is your reward in heaven. I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it right in front of me. But, you know, rejoice when people persecute you. Again, it's easy for me to give you that advice because I'm not the person who's going to lose their livelihood in some measure here. But blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. And I offer you that because this is what Jesus said. And I was encouraged because I heard Bill Craig say the same thing, the Christian philosopher William Lane Craig, when someone asked him, how's he deal in debates with people who are so abusive? He said, Jesus said to rejoice. And he cited this passage. So I thought, gee, duh. So because your reward in heaven will be great. So if you have to suffer for righteousness' sake, you have chosen the better portion.
Thank you for that word.
Okay. Well, Bill, it's a pleasure to talk with you, an honor. And I know Bill isn't your real name. And I hope someday, maybe after you've kind of had to navigate some of these issues, you can call me back and tell me how it went. Maybe you'll have some suggestions for adjustments that you think will be good for other people that might benefit from that too.
I would love that, Greg. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Bill. All the best to you.
All right, bye.
Bye. That was a good call. And it just surprises me sometimes that if I sat down to think about that, I probably wouldn't come up with much because I have thought about it before. But when you're actually engaged in conversation, iron sharpening iron, you know, things come up, and Bill offered some thoughts that were helpful to me too. Anyway, we've got to start thinking through this because this kind of thing is going to be coming up in lots of different professions much more aggressively. And the group that we're dealing with here is litigious. They want to hurt people who disagree. All right, let's take a very quick break, and then we'll come back to Mobile, Alabama. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market, and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All right, friends. Back with you here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, and in Mobile, Alabama, Landon. Hi there, Landon.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking the call, bud.
Sure. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just had a kind of a quick question. I've been talking to a fellow about some texts in the scriptures, and how do we know in our present time that, for example, the way some of the language in the New Testament is, like when Luke opens up his gospel and the account of Acts, like he addresses it to Theophilus, and when Paul writes his letters, it's to the church at Philippi.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know that those guys intended those letters to be read by the church at large for the continuation of the church age, and that its truths would sort of, you know, carry on, so to speak, that they weren't just directed specifically to those people at that time, at that place, for
right,
that reason?
Right. Well, that, in part, you know the answer. Let me start by saying there's no simple answer to your question, because it kind of depends. You know, in some cases, because the writer says, these are the things that I instruct all the churches. Or the writer says, I want this letter that I'm sending to you to be read in the other churches in the area. And I think it's pretty straightforward, common sense notion that if he wants other churches to read it, it's not because they just happen to be in the same general geological area, but nobody outside of that does the letter pertain to. And rather, this is more what they call a general epistle. All right? In fact, that's what they're called, the epistles or letter to the Romans or to the Corinthians, Galatians, I should say. I guess the Corinthians, Galatians, the Hebrews. These are general epistles, okay? These are written to broad, large groups of people, okay? Other places, other letters are written specifically to individual congregations to reply to a specific need. Philippians is written to the church at Philippi, and there in chapter 3 you see a specific circumstance being addressed about a conflict between two people, Euodia and Syntyche, okay? Well, obviously, that's an individual circumstance that is meant to be addressed there. That admonition, that true comrade, whoever that is, you know, adjudicate between these two people and settle this problem, that admonition is not an admonition to the church for all ages. But that's about that problem. But what we can see is the way Paul addresses problems. Two people are fighting. Somebody else in the church, help out. That seems to me a legitimate generalization from that specific circumstance. Okay?
Okay. So for somebody to make the statement that, you know, let's say it's Paul in Philippians, he didn't intend for people, you know, throughout time to read this and draw, you know, truths and principles from it. You have to so contextualize it to that time period that it actually stops there, and then that's it.
Somebody makes that claim, I'm going to ask him, why would he think that that's the case? I can make the case regarding that little paragraph that I just described out of Philippians, because it's obviously applying to Euodia and Syntyche, okay? However, when you read the broader letter of Philippians, you can see that what Paul is addressing there are larger issues that pertain not just to the unique circumstances of Philippi, but to the Philippian Christians as Christians. And insofar as it addresses them as Christians, then any Christian can benefit from what Paul told the Philippian Christians. Now, that what I just identified, though, is a judgment call. One has to look at the context and see whether the things that are being said here seem to be things that apply directly to a unique set of circumstances, and therefore, as such, prima facie, just the way he's given it, doesn't apply to us, like meat sacrificed to idols. We don't have that stuff here in our culture, but or not. And if it doesn't apply, is there some larger thing in play that's evidenced by the particulars which no longer apply, but which larger thing might apply? So, I mean, these are legitimate questions of biblical interpretation. Paul was an apostle to the Gentiles. by his own admission. So when he sends letters of instruction to Gentile Christians, I have no reason to think that these don't have broader application to Gentile Christians, even though he is there addressing a specific congregation. Let me give you an example of this problem that I'm describing. A lot of people miss this. Jesus' final discourse was the Upper Room Discourse. This is the Last Supper. We read the details most extensively in John 13 through 17. And in the Upper Room Discourse, Jesus gives final instructions. But he is giving a lot of different things there. And sometimes he seems to be talking to the disciples as believers. If I go, I prepare a place for you, and I will go and bring you back. You know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That isn't just for those 11 people. That seems to be a broader thing. But when he gives other directives and he says that the Holy Spirit will bring to you, will guide you into all truth and bring to your remembrance everything I have taught you, well, that sounds like he's talking to the disciples as disciples, giving them an authority that you and I as followers of Christ would not have. Now, how do you know that in any given text? You just got to read carefully and come to your best judgment. And that's a passage I think a lot of Christians have misunderstood. The Bible says the Holy Spirit will lead us into all truth. Yeah, he wasn't talking about you. He's talking about the disciples. Because if he meant you and me and we're differing on this, then obviously he failed. Because we would be agreeing on this if that was for all of us.
But, right, yeah. So, and I think what is just a little bit difficult possibly is, you know, for example, in 1 Corinthians, you know, what's mentioned with a lot of the ecstatic behavior from the Corinthian during that time
speaking
period.
Speaking in tongues, right.
Yeah, there's typically references to Delphi the Oracle and whatnot. Now, you don't really see any of that external evidence in the text, so you have to go outside of the text.
That's right.
In order to sort of draw,
you have no other choice. That's correct. I'm speeding up here because we're almost out of time. Yes, you're right. No, that's all right. You're onto it. And some of this stuff takes additional study because all writing is in a context. All of those writings are in a context of a culture, and we are not in that culture anymore. We are far removed in distance and time, and consequently, we have to be careful how we read things. And that's why genre and historical circumstances and everything is so important. So it's not tidy, but it can be done. And hope that some of the things I've offered, Landon, will help you out. Okay, that's it for the hour, my friends. And more ahead. Stay with us on Stand to Reason. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Glad to be part of your afternoon or evening or morning or whatever it happens to be. You never know with podcasting. Some of you are sitting in your homes, others driving a car. Some of you may be jogging or working out or biking or who knows what else. But glad you're on board in any event. And I got lots of callers here I want to get to very quickly. I want to offer a thought that I've been having about something recently. This probably will not take very long, but I just want to I want to suggest this to you. My concern is the broad concern. I'll give you the broad concern, and then I want to mention something about C.S. Lewis that I noticed kind of in passing, something that you might not have seen because it's subtle in Lewis's writing, but I think it's intentional. So here's the broad general thing. I am concerned by a kind of mood of triumphalism among Christians. Now, what I mean by triumphalism is kind of the standard expression that everything's wonderful with God, might be one way of putting it. Now, is God wonderful? Yes, God is wonderful, but is everything wonderful with God? Well, that's not true. Now, I guess if you are really, really totally spiritual, much beyond where I'm at right now, then you could say, even though I'm miserable, everything's wonderful, and I really mean it. I think it's interesting, though, when I, say, read Paul, at least some of the places where he is very candid about his own trials and difficulties and tribulations. And by the way, he is very mature Christian, obviously. And he rejoiced in the midst of the most difficult circumstances. But I'm looking here in 2 Corinthians 4, and he says, we are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not despairing. We are persecuted, but not forsaken. We are struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifest in our body. We who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifest in our mortal flesh. Okay, there is a reality. We are delivered over to death. Paul paid more literally than we generally are, but there's this two-sided thing, and then the life of Christ is manifest. But being in the midst of that is a pain sometimes. It doesn't feel wonderful. Writer of Hebrews, all discipline for the moment does not seem to be joyful, but sorrowful. But afterwards, for those who have been trained by it, yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Now, here's my beef with the body of Christ, and that is sometimes we kind of put on a nice face and we pretend that everything's always wonderful when life is hard, and then you die. And for some, life is harder than for others, and there seems to be sometimes this sense of obligation that we always have to pretend like everything's going just great, when in fact, in this world, you have tribulation. And not that we have to be maudlin about it or complaining or down in our cups or whatever all the time, but just to be realistic about it. Weep with those who weep, kind of thing, all right? So my concern broadly is this overemphasis on this triumphalism, and that when when you hear the testimonies, they're always testimonies of success. That is, you get the thing prayed for. The person got healed. The person got saved. The thing happened. We got the job. Hallelujah, praise the Lord. And that's entirely appropriate. But what about those and others? Remember that from Hebrews 11? Yes, all those that by faith were delivered and others were not delivered, but also were not delivered in their faith. That is, their faith was full and legitimate, and they trusted the Lord, but they did get delivered. And so sometimes we don't kind of give a proper place to that. Okay, so that's my concern. And this is one thing that I appreciate about Lewis. So here's the thing I noticed in Lewis. So I'm reading in his fantasy stuff. We're listening to the CDs, the Focus of the Family produced a fabulous set of CDs on the Chronicles of Narnia. And in fact, on a long drive with my daughter yesterday, 4 hours in the car, we were listening a good portion of the time to The Magician's Nephew, wonderfully produced by the Focus on the Family crowd. And if you don't have these, you need to get them. Okay, end of issue. Get them on Amazon. That's the simplest, least expensive way to get them, but they're fabulous. All the Chronicles there acted out. A bit aggressive maybe for youngsters. My six-year-old still has a little bit of trouble because they're dramatically done. But in any event, have you ever noticed if you've read the Chronicles that there are times when long journeys are necessary to get from, you know, from one place to another? This is a whole continent that you have Narnia in the north, you have Arkenland, you've got, what's that place in the south where all those warlike people live? I can't remember the details. The point is there's a lot of geography to cover. And what Lewis does not do when he sets kids out on a journey is he does not make the journey easy. Whether the journey's on land or by a boat. Have you noticed that sometimes the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and they get into a storm and the storm lasts for like a week? It's a long time to be riding in a small boat being pitched to and fro. Or the horse and the boy, they got to travel across the desert. It takes a long time. They don't just get on, pant, pant, pant. Oh, I'm thirsty. Oh, good. Here's the stream. Oh, we're there. It's over with. No, it's day after day after day of arduous, monotonous journey until finally, through many tribulations, they attain their goal. Now, I appreciate that Lewis does this, and I think he's doing it on purpose because he is giving us a picture of the journey. He emphasizes the distance between the destinations. He is straightforward about the tedium and the toil of the travel. He is acknowledging the hungers that aren't satisfied and the thirst and how you go on and go on and you don't think you could take another step. And in The Horse and the Boy, that's when the lion comes out of the thicket and nips at the heels of the horse. And the boy goes taking off in the back of the horse, and they go, they didn't think they can go another step, and now there's a lion nipping at their heels, and they find a reserve of energy, which was necessary to accomplish the task, they find out later. And I appreciate that Lewis is, and this is something I don't want my children to miss as we revisit these stories. What is Lewis telling us? He's telling us that the journey is hard, that the journey is a challenge, that it takes time, that there is tedium, there is toil, there is great distance between the destinations. And don't expect things to happen quickly. And remember that Aslan guy? He's not a tame lion. And have you noticed in the Narnian tales that Aslan, for the true believer, is out there in the distance somewhere, but he doesn't show up very often. He seems to show up when he's most desperately needed, and then it becomes clear that he's never really been very far all along, but he doesn't intervene and he doesn't interfere. Lewis lost his mother, I think, as a child. He lost his wife as an adult, his wife of 3 years, Joy Davidman. He understands loss. He understands unanswered prayer. And he understands that both of these things and the toil and the hardship and the tedium of the travel are part of the normal, ordinary Christian life. So no inappropriate triumphalism there for him, yet appropriately triumphant in understanding the ultimate realities. And those are all communicated so well in those wonderful stories for children and for adults, for you and I. So I hope you benefit from them. All right, having said that, let's go to Calgary. Canada, and Nick. Hello, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Mr. Coco. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Last time I was in Calgary, actually, I was just a little bit south of Calgary in Fort something or other, starts with an M, and it was like 26 below zero Fahrenheit.
That cold. Sounds about right for that time of year. I met you when you were in Calgary, actually.
Was this the last time? That was in January.
Yeah. If you don't remember me, I'm the person who exposed your horrible knowledge of Canadian geography.
Oh gosh. Okay. That was
you
on a call,
the
right?
I
was
all I know.
Well, I was just confused. I mean, I know Calgary is in Alberta, and Alberta is a province, and Calgary is a city, like Calgary Stampede. But I was just really confused that day. So
that's all right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, nice to talk with you again, and you're free to correct any other mistakes I make, sir.
No, I don't think I have any off the top of my head. But I was listening a couple weeks ago, and I mean, this is probably a long-standing problem as of late, but you were getting a lot of calls about the whole issue of the gender reassignment, politically correct kind of thing.
Terminology,
going on where,
is it, yeah.
Yeah, and I could, you know, I can hear you kind of at a loss, as I am, because, you know, you really can't. It's hard to appeal to the logical side of it. It seems like people just don't want to hear it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I heard you saying, oh, I need to do some more thinking about it, and, you know, and I assume that meant, you know, maybe tactically or trying to find a better analogy.
Uh-huh.
And I usually use the one about the rabbit, and of course, I mean, once again, I follow the logic perfectly, but I can see, you know, somebody being like, oh, how dare you say something about a rabbit, and,
right,
you know.
Just for the other listeners, I was saying, what if a person, this is regarding the young boy who thought he was a girl, and so the act of love was to treat the boy like a girl, allegedly the act of love, and this is what was the subject of the conversation. And then, and I used the illustration, what if the boy thought he was a rabbit? Would you put him in a hutch because he wanted that and feed him carrots and change his ears to long ears and put fur on his back and stuff like that because you're being loving towards them? And I admit that this is somewhat of an extreme parallel or illustration, because I do think there's a parallel there. And it's only one of degree, but not one of kind. It's one of degree, not kind. That's why I think it's a legitimate parallel. But I have to say something as extreme as that, in my own defense here, because you can't parody this stuff. And I think even at the time, and Nick, even at the time, I think I said, just, you know, the danger of using the rabbit illustration is that somebody's going to say you're going to read in the news that somebody in Europe somewhere probably said thought they were a rabbit, and so they passed a law and said they got to change his ears, you know, some ridiculous thing like that. But anyway.
Yeah, no, like I said, I follow the logic of it perfectly. It makes perfect sense, but, you know, when you're trying to reason with these people, it the logic doesn't appeal to them. And so I was trying myself to think of, you know, well, what would be an illustration or a comparison that would maybe hit a little closer to home or would maybe appeal to a more real-life situation that people can relate to nowadays, like because they haven't heard of somebody who thinks they're a rabbit kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered that I had read a book by Michael Brown. I'm not sure if you have read any of his stuff.
I have like five of his books that he gave to me. God bless him. There are he's got a massive tome on homosexuality and then a number of other books dealing with Jewish evangelism. And I was actually on a show about a month ago. And so we know each other professionally, and he was nice to interview me on, I think, on the tactics issue, but he's made quite a contribution apparently in this broader area. Did he come up with something that's a little more serviceable than my rabbit illustration?
I think so, and I think he kind of did it almost more observationally than actually kind of you know, throwing it out there that somebody could use. But the book is called The Queer Thing Happened to America, and that's probably the one you're talking about.
Right.
It's a really, really detailed book about the whole, you know, march of gay activism. And I would recommend it to anyone. But what he talks about is there's actually something. Well, there's two examples that he gives. So the first one is he likens it to somebody who is an anorexic, who actually, you know, who is a, you know, I mean, picture the anorexic girl who has, you know, been suffering this way for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You picture this 85-pound girl, ribs sticking out, standing in front of the mirror, absolutely 100% convinced
she's
that
fat.
She is obese.
Yeah.
she's obese and, mm-hmm. and she needs to fix it. Mm-hmm. And she's willing to do anything, and it, I mean, it can kill people, right? And
yes.
so, and he kind of said, would the loving thing to do to intervene surgically and give that girl liposuction?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or, you know, or would it be loving to come alongside that person and say, you know, you are absolutely right, and we need to help you embrace the real you, so we're going to get you a personal trainer and put you on a, you know, 1,000-calorie-a-day diet, if they're even willing to do that, and we're going to drop you down to 65 pounds.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that is a good, you, yeah, that's a good illustration.
That's,
yeah. I wonder
so that's
if...
A, that's a,
I was going to say, I wonder if somebody might object that it's not parallel because being anorexic is clearly life damaging or something like that. Now, I think you could argue that, well, homosexuality is life threatening in many ways. You look at the statistics, but gender confusion itself may not be. I'm just thinking about the potential pushback. I wrote it down on my notes here because I think that's a good, that is a good suggestion.
And I figured you, if there was a hole to be picked in it, I figured you would probably pick the hole in it. So.
Well, that would be my objection if I were the other side. I would say that's not
okay,
parallel.
Then,
okay, so you got another alternative?
I have another one, and this is I think it's actually hard to believe, but it's actually real. So he actually refers to something that is called, I guess the street name, I can't remember the actual name for it, but the street name for it is called body integrity identity disorder or something like that.
Body integrity identity disorder?
Disorder.
All right.
Yes.
What
and,
the heck is
and,
that?
And you might want to look it up. It's in the book towards the end of the book if you want to look it up and you want to, you know, if you ever want to kind of look into it further. But basically, this is actually a mental disorder where people are absolutely tormented by the fact that they have they believe with you know on a you know very obviously deep-seated level that they were actually supposed to be an amputee.
Oh my.
They actually yes, and it sounds it's real, and these people actually are tormented by their legs. The cases that he lists are their legs. They feel like I'm not supposed to have these legs. I was meant to be an amputee, and they actually pursued surgical intervention to have their legs removed. There was a doctor in Scotland, I believe, that actually performed a couple surgeries. He chopped off the legs of two guys, perfectly functioning legs, in order to satisfy what was
you know what's interesting,
the mental problem.
And I see the parallel here with surgery for transsexuals. And you know, if we can try really hard and step outside of our distorted cultural bias now, we'd realize that, I mean, I think we'd be, it would be accurate to admit that probably having our sexual organs removed is more radical than having your legs removed.
Well, in a sense. And of course, I mean, these people were, both of them, I think, that had their legs removed, claimed in their interviews that they were happier now that they were not, you know, and I mean, and of course, I'm sure that this doctor got extreme pushback from the medical community and whatever else.
Well, I hope so, but you never know. Again, you cannot parody these kinds of things. Who knows,
exactly.
But the ACLU there in England or whoever it was, it's got, you know, said the basically, you know, campaigned on his behalf. Who knows? So anyway.
But yeah, so, you know, I figure if something like, you know, gender identity is seriously so open for dispute the way that, you know, the way that they talk about it. Like, this is so open. There's nothing fixed here at all. Then I don't see how, you know, it would be any less loving to come alongside this person who seriously thinks with everything inside of them that they were meant to have no legs.
Right.
And the loving thing to do, because the appeal is always made to this horribly distorted view of love. You know, so you got to kind of go back to that. Well, would you consider it loving? Was it loving of this doctor to actually remove the perfectly functioning legs of these individuals for the sake of their
identity,
whatever, their satisfaction or their mental wholeness, so to speak, there, obviously.
Well, I think of this one passage in John, and I think I brought this up, but in 1 Corinthians 13, the lengthiest passage on love, it says that the love does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in the truth. And so anyway... Yeah, well, I'll have to consider that next time around, Nick, next time this issue comes up, although I just find the rabbit thing so handy, you know, in some circumstances. That because I can actually think of people who might side with the anorexic or with the body integrity person who's an amputee, as crazy as that sounds. But it's I'm trying to find an illustration that is legitimately parallel, but it's so out there that a person would sound stupid to affirm it. Now, maybe the amputee thing is pretty stupid. The anorexic, I'm afraid with the anorexic one, people say, well, that's ridiculous because she's dying, you know, and you don't want to help her die. But this
she'd be happy if she would just, you know, drop down to, like, maybe she wouldn't die. She would just be, you know, obviously, you know, an unhealthy weight. Yeah. And I get it. Like, like you said, you can't parody it, but and I know the rabbit one is pretty much clean cut. It's kind of a knockdown like I can just see somebody dismissing that more, you know, without even really thinking about it, just because, oh, come on, you're talking about a rabbit, we're talking about people, you know, or something.
I'm talking about a person, too. I'm talking about a person who thinks they're a rabbit. Okay, yeah, so I'd want to fight back a little bit on that one, but your body integrity identity disorder, if I can remember the phraseology, a body integrity...
It's in that book that he gave you.
Pardon me?
If he gave you A Queer Thing Happened to America, then it's in that
it's
book.
It's in there,
talks about it.
Yeah. Well, I'd still, I mean, for usage when I'm talking and carrying on conversations, this body integrity identity disorder, that's a good line, because if you can give the exact wording here, it sounds like it has more credibility. Instead of just saying, well, what if a person wanted to have his legs cut off because in their personal identity they didn't believe they were supposed to have legs, they believed they were amputees. Well, that kind of stuff actually took place in England, and there are people that believe that kind of thing. So how is this different? So that sounds more serviceable to me. Nick, I got to run.
Sounds good.
Got a break.
Nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, and thanks. You didn't even have to correct me on anything. So
yeah, you did good today. You did really good. I didn't ask you about geography, that's why.
Oh, that's right. Okay, great. Thanks. Thanks so much for the call. Got to go to break. More coming up on Stand to Reason.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com. and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central, topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study The Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order The Bible Fast Forward.
Back at you here at Stand to Reason. Just got a news flash from the Enforcer here. This is a piece I was actually reading something about this in another piece earlier today. Nine Things You Should Know About Transgenderism. That's what I was reading, but it referred to, I think, the same Dr. Paul McHugh, former psychiatrist in chief at Johns Hopkins Hospital, who has penned a revealing column in the Wall Street Journal, apparently, challenging the notion that sex reassignment surgery, that would be, I thought that that meant transsexual, but transsexual is a little broader than that based on these definitions now. It's hard to keep track of it all. But in any event, I think you know what sex reassignment surgery amounts to. He says he's challenging the notion that it is actually good for so-called transgendered persons. Transgendered are people who identify or express an identity, gender identity, that does not match their physical sex, all right? Now, I'm just reading the sight unseen here. The enforcer handed it to me, but she said it was good. So let me just read what he writes in the Wall Street Journal. Is that it may be today? I'm not sure the date. This is June 13th that the piece I'm reading from now came out. So within the last few days, I suspect you'll find this in the Wall Street Journal. And here's what he writes. This is McHugh. Dr. Paul McHugh, you won't hear it from those championing transgender equality, but controlled and follow-up studies reveal fundamental problems with this movement. When children who reported transgender feelings were tracked without medical or surgical treatment at both Vanderbilt University and London's Portman Clinic, 70 to 80% of them spontaneously lost those feelings. 70 to 80% spontaneously lost those feelings. So, which is to say, if parents are not encouraged to love their kids into this new identity, chances are 5 to 1 that this so-called new identity will dissipate shortly into the identity that matches their physical body, which I think everybody would pretty much admit is probably a better circumstance. Now, he did say that some 25% had persistent feelings, but what differentiates those individuals remains to be discerned. So 70 to 80% spontaneously lost those feelings, and the remainder maintained those feelings, but, okay, what's the significance of that? That's what he's asking. He continues, we at Johns Hopkins University, which in the 60s was the first American medical center to venture into sex reassignment surgery, launched a study in the 70s comparing the outcomes of transgendered people who had the surgery with the outcomes of those who did not. Okay, so most, that is, those who continued on with the persistent feelings, some had surgery, some had did not. So what happened to them? Most of the surgically treated patients described themselves as satisfied by the results, but their subsequent psychosocial adjustments were no better than those who didn't have the surgery. The short study here is the quick study. Surgery didn't change anything. That's the point he's making. And so, he continues, at Hopkins, we stopped doing sex reassignment surgery since producing a satisfied but still troubled patient seemed an inadequate reason for surgically amputating normal organs. Well put. And then he had this to say about parents who are allowing doctors to treat their transgendered children. He writes, then there is the subgroup of very young, often prepubescent children who notice distinct sex roles in the culture and, exploring how they fit in, begin imitating the opposite sex. Misguided doctors at medical centers, including Boston's Children's Hospital, have begun trying to treat this behavior by administering puberty-delaying hormones to render later sex change surgeries less onerous. That means less troublesome if they want to have the surgery when they're an adult. Even though the drugs stunt the children's growth and risk causing sterility. Given that close to 80% of such children would abandon their confusion, glad he calls it that, and grow naturally, I'm glad he calls it that, into adult life if untreated, these medical interventions come close to child abuse. A better way to help these children? Devoted parenting. Close quote. Powerful. It's so refreshing when somebody with credentials says the obvious thing that even uneducated people can see, but are dismissed as being backward and provincial if they say the obvious. Well, here's a smart guy who's saying the obvious as well. Once again, this is Dr. Paul McHugh, former chief, psychiatric chief at Johns Hopkins Hospital. This piece in the Wall Street Journal. Actually, I can get the link there, but within the last, the piece is called Transgender Surgery Isn't the Solution. You can look at Twitter or on our blog tomorrow and you'll get the link there, but it's certainly worth reading. Okay, thank you, Enforcer. Let's go to Boise, Idaho, and this is Chris. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Greg. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Nice to talk with you.
Well, I have a couple Lutheran friends, and, you know, I've been a believer for over 20 years, and this really has never come up, but the Lord's Supper has come up recently, and we've been talking about it in depth, and they take the view that, you know, because the Lord said, this is my body,
right,
that they actually believe it's the literal body, that they're eating the literal flesh and drinking the literal blood of Christ, and they back it up with that scripture in particular and a few others, and the early church fathers and tradition.
By the way, are you talking about Lutheran friends or Roman Catholic friends?
Well, I've been talking with Lutheran friends, but I've been listening to some things online, and obviously the Roman Catholics believe similar.
Well, the distinction is significant, at least to Lutherans and Roman Catholics.
Sure.
Because what you just described sounded more to me like the Roman Catholic view of transubstantiation, where you have the where you have the body and blood of Christ literally present there in the Lord's Supper.
That's true. And then they consider that it's not actually the bread and wine doesn't actually turn into the body and blood, but it's the accidental portion. It's the substance. It's the real presence.
Well, okay, yeah. Just to clarify the terms, it's the substance, but not the accidents. The accidental properties, which are the kind of things that would allow us to recognize something as wine or flesh, these are not present. Those are the accidental properties, but the substance is there. And the Roman Catholics would say the substance is literally in the elements change literally into the substance. And I think the Lutheran view is going to be somewhat similar, but not quite the same. That is, and I'm trying to think of the terminology, but in and under the elements, you have the true body of Christ, something to that effect. Now, I got to be careful because Melinda's a former Lutheran, and I've got two active Lutherans also on staff, and they might storm the heights here if I don't get it right. But there is a significant difference, but they are much more literalist in a certain sense than, say, Reform guys who see this as more of a representative, so to speak.
A remembrance,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think that line of argument, there may be good reasons to argue for the Lutheran or the Catholic view, and I know Luther carved into the table where he was seated during this debate, you know, this is my body, you know, with a penknife or something, to make a fuss about the particular words. But I think that is a poor way of arguing for the view, because there are many things, even in that same discussion. Jesus said, I am the vine. That's in John 15. It happened in the same discussion, the upper room discourse, as the Last Supper. Yet we could carve that into a wooden table, I am the vine, but we don't think that he's made of branches, you know, or we don't think that the accidents aren't there, but the substance is there of being a grapevine. No, we don't think that. We understand that he was using a figure of speech. And that's why I think this is a weak way of arguing. I think there might be other ways of arguing that are stronger, but using that proof texting, I think, is not adequate. There are too many times where Scripture, you know, under God's pinions, we find protection. Well, pinions are feathers, but does that mean God's got wings? It's a figure of speech. But it does say his pinions, for goodness sake. So there it is, straight as, clear as day, you know.
Right.
Well, it just strikes me that a very legitimate case can be made that this is a figure of speech, and it isn't univocal, that it isn't so obvious that that's what he said, that's what he means.
But if when they bring up the church fathers and this is what they believe from the beginning, what's the tactical approach? What do I mean?
Well, I think there's merit in what the church fathers say, but the church fathers are not the church fathers are not inspired writ. We have to go back to what the text itself says. The church fathers end up not agreeing on a number of things. They get some things wrong, and I'm not going to launch a broadside against the fathers. Mm-hmm. I'm just simply saying that this is worthwhile, but it isn't the final. It isn't the scripture is the final. Is the final arbiter here?
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, there. It looks as though that they would break fellowship with me over this. I wouldn't. I've never thought of this as something I would break fellowship over them over.
Yeah.
But it is something they would not they would not allow me to take communion with.
Yes.
Them.
Well, breaking fellowship with you and not sharing communion are two different things.
Okay.
They could still have fellowship with you as Christians, but then to share at the communion table, there's a sensibility about this that you have to judge the Lord's Supper properly in order to take it rightly. And Paul warns the Corinthians that some people who have not done so have gotten sick and some others have died. Mm-hmm. Now, what it means, so I think that's a legitimate concern. What it means to judge it rightly and taking it properly, that's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have to say I, for one, have not gone into this in any depth. And when I read, say, some of this about Corinthians where this discussion takes place, it seems, from my understanding, is that people were going to the Lord's Supper and they were gorging themselves. They were making a meal out of it. And so they were not taking it properly. They were acting inappropriately with regards to the solemn sacrament, and consequently bringing judgment on themselves. It is not clear to me that these are bringing judgment on themselves because they didn't realize they were really eating the real presence of Christ. And they thought they were only eating bread and drinking wine, and therefore the judgment came. That isn't clear to me from the passage.
So how should I be seeing the Lord's Supper?
Well, I see it as a memorial. I do not see transubstantiation or real presence, okay? Transubstantiation being the Roman Catholic view, real presence being the Lutheran view. I have not been compelled by those arguments. And incidentally, for those who want to make the case that this is somehow necessary as part of our, you know, salvific participation or exercises, Jesus gave both the bread and the cup. And so why is it that those traditions that teach, well, I'm thinking more of the Roman Catholic tradition now, only give the wafer and not the cup, if the wafer and the cup themselves represent the transubstantiated body of Christ? This is the body of Christ and this is the blood of Christ.
I understand that the Catholics view that, and this is, I think, at the Vatican II or Trent, I can't remember which, but that they consider the wafer the body and blood.
All right. Okay. Well, you know, to me, this almost sounds like storytelling, you know, at this point. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is how we get around with it. We'll just call it the body and blood. Look, if you're just going to take these accounts in a straightforward way, if Jesus said you got to eat my flesh and drink my blood, that's John 6, and what he was talking about was the Last Supper, and then he gives his body, which is the bread, and the blood, which is the wine, well, then, you know, you can't change the definitions down the line 1,600 years later. You know, this is, seems to, let's just play consistently here.
Mm-hmm.
But you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. I think that's the way I view that. Do this in remembrance of me. Don't do this to eat me. Mm-hmm. Do this in remembrance of me. I think there's latitude there for a remembrance type of view. I don't think it necessarily takes anything away from it, but I guess if you really think you're eating Jesus' body and drinking his blood, that's a little bit more dramatic than just having piece of bread and some wine or grape juice as a remembrance. I agree. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, you know, it was against the Jewish law to drink blood.
Right. I did bring that up from Leviticus, I think it's 17. But they said it, well, one of them said that it was the blood of animals, and who we didn't want the life of blood of animals within us, but we do want the life of Jesus within us. So that would be.
All right. That sounds like more storytelling. Okay. The text said, don't drink blood. Are you saying that it only meant animals, but it's okay to drink human blood?
That's Jesus' blood, yes. That's what he's saying.
Well, all right. That does not strike me as an obvious application of the text. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
So how should I...
You know, I can't answer the question for you except for in a general sense. I think what you have to do is you have to look at the arguments for the three distinct views, look at the texts, and ask yourself what seems to make the best sense. I'm not going to campaign aggressively for one over the other, although I've campaigned a little bit against the first two, but because I'm not schooled enough, I think, in the details of the argument, nor do I care that much about it to get schooled in the details of it.
Yeah, I guess that's why I haven't covered it in 20 years.
Well, look, if I'm proclaiming the Lord's death until he comes, commemorating with the bread, do this in remembrance of me, then how is it that I'm somehow dishonoring God because I don't understand the peculiarities of it the way, excuse me, that somebody else does, you know? I don't see how that's going to create a problem. So that doesn't seem to be in the text that you got to understand all these details. Anyway, got to run. Okay, Chris?
Thank you.
Yeah, and I appreciate
it. One other quick... I don't have
time for it. I got to get to another caller. We're almost out of time, okay? Thanks so much for the call. And I'm going to just skip this break because we've got an interview coming up next hour, and I want to get to some of the others. Let's talk with Brian in Cincinnati, Ohio. Brian, welcome
Hello.
To the show. Hi.
Hi. I would just want to say quickly thank you for your ministry over all the years.
You've
been an incredible help to me.
Thanks.
And I just had a quick question about I have a leftover occult literature in my house. Now, there's a wide variety of it, and when I say variety, I mean topical. And and I just, based on what your answer to that question is, I wanted to push back a little bit. Basically, do I need to get rid of it, and if so, how would I dispose of it?
Well, the example that we have scripturally is from the Ephesian Christians who had a lot of occultic material and they burned it.
Right. I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. So whether it's required to burn it, remember that the Book of Acts is descriptive, not necessarily prescriptive. It tells what they did, not what is obligatory. Whether it's required to burn it, I'm not going to say that's the case. But if I had a bunch of occultic literature, I'd want to trash it. I'd want to get that. I just want to get it out of my house. There's an exception to this. I'll tell you in a moment. I'd want to get it out of my house, and I'd want to get rid of it in a way that nobody else could be hurt by it. So burning it is a good example, trashing it, shredding it. However, you know, I don't think that there's spiritual power in the thing itself, in the object.
Nor do I.
But, you know, stuff is creepy. And I have a friend that I haven't seen him in many, many years. He may not even still be alive. His name is John Weldon. We were roommates for a while back in the 70s. John has written probably more about the occults and the occult than any person alive, I think. And he had all of these books that he had to keep because they were part of his research. But, man, it was a burden on him, I think, to have all of this stuff and have to plow through all of that stuff. So I think if you don't have any genuine academic interest in this, just get rid of it. If you're not an author...
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
to some degree I do, because I'm really interested in other worldviews, and that's why I have it to begin with. It was mm-hmm. because on my journey to Christ was, you know, investigating all these other things.
Right.
Now, I definitely know that intent is a big, part of the issue, and mm-hmm. so I don't have any intent to practice any of this
right.
stuff. So some of the instructional things could definitely be gotten rid of, but
yeah.
how far do I go then from there? Do I get rid of any stories that are, any other literature, like fictional tales that are heavily occultic in nature, or especially with regards to music? Like, I have a huge music collection,
yeah.
records and CDs, and I've noticed that you guys, you know, even I think last week or the week before, you guys even used a Beatles song, which... I know that that particular song wasn't, you know, overtly
yeah.
occultic, but they, of course, they are proponents of occultic.
They had a lot of odd views, right, yeah. And I don't think that just playing the music of somebody who's got odd views somehow makes you complicit in the views.
Nor do I.
Yeah, well, the answer, I can't actually give an answer to your question because it's not clear to me that there's a moral rule that applies. I think that what the Ephesians did is instructive. But I don't, and so you can't go wrong by getting rid of it all, you know, and just kind of making a clean break with it. But I don't
right.
agree that there's any badness attached to the articles themselves. They still seem a little creepy to me. But again, if you have a legitimate academic interest in it that's kingdom related, then I think then you're going to have to make your own decision about some of this stuff. It's just not a question that I can answer for you.
Well, more than anything, I just was curious about how to dispose of it, because I felt that it would not be a good idea to take them to some secondhand bookstore,
no,
you know,
no.
and then sell them there,
no.
and then someone else picks it up.
Well, what you might want to check with is a Christian college that has that may have a library of that material, and they might make use of it, and then I just donate it. But what
okay.
I think this is a significant consideration. You don't want it to put it. Don't want to dispose of it in a way that it can do damage in somebody else's life.
No, I don't.
Okay, so either that would be giving it to someone else who is going to have a measured, appropriate use of it, or destroy it completely. Get
okay.
rid of it in a way that it can't hurt anybody else. Have it shredded, burned, whatever.
Okay. I'll have to use discernment on which ones to get rid of then. Okay, thank you.
There you go, Brian. Yeah, it's a tough call here, but I appreciate the question and it's going to be a conscience issue at this point. Let's go to Carmel, California, and Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Greg. You and the wife came up to Monterey, I recall, a couple of years ago, right?
We did. In 2010, we did a conference up there that we attended. That was pretty neat for us. It was beautiful up there, Carmel.
Great.
Yeah.
We're having a great salmon year up here, too.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to Wisconsin in a few days, so hopefully I'll wet a line out there.
Okay, you won't get seasick.
No, I won't.
you stand to reason as doing such bold work on the issue of homosexuality, and especially what Alan's been writing, and it's really helped me in talking to my adult children who are just perplexed at giving answers to this issue, and
mm-hmm.
I just want to commend you on that. And I
Thanks.
Wanted to know if you were aware of Governor Perry's comments at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco earlier this week.
Oh, no, I'm not aware of them. I have actually been been a guest at the Commonwealth Club as a speaker at least twice, maybe three times. It's a wildly leftist enterprise, but they occasionally have conservatives speak there. It's largely a political thing, but I got a chance to do a couple of things there and hopefully have a spiritual impact. But what was it that he said?
Well, here's the quote. When he was asked if he believed homosexuality was a disorder, okay, so kind of a leading question there, but he responded, quote, whether or not you feel compelled to follow a particular lifestyle or not, you have the ability to decide not to do that.
Yeah.
And he added, I may have the genetic coding that I'm inclined to be an alcoholic, but I have the desire not to do that, and I look at the homosexual issue in the same way.
Uh-huh.
Now, first of all, you know, I can't think of any politician that wants to go within 10 feet of that issue
uh-huh.
right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought tactically it was a very good answer.
Very cagey.
He's getting hammered for it everywhere, but I thought it was pretty tactically sound. Your comment on that?
Yeah. No, I was pretty cagey. You know, he brings in alcoholism. You know that, and are you equating homosexuality with alcoholism? There's nothing that you're going to say that's going to be substantive that isn't, you're not going to get hammered for. But I thought, you know, as far as it went, it was a pretty cagey response. Regardless of the genetics, people can still say no. Now, he said, though, I have a desire to say no to alcohol, even if I have an alcoholic tendency. And maybe the other side could say, yeah, okay, we don't have the desire to say no to our homosexuality. I would have tried a different tack if I was in that person situation. Instead of answering the question directly, I would say, what would you say about somebody who had eyes but couldn't see? Would you consider this to be something that was benign? Okay, or legs but they couldn't walk. Okay, what about a person who has sexual organs that were designed for one purpose but is dispositionally incapable of using it for that purpose? What would you consider that? Would you consider this normal? And leave it at that.
Right.
And if somebody pressed me, I'd say, well, if a person has sexual organs for a woman but cannot use them with a woman for whatever disposition that they have, that strikes me as odd.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it strike you as odd?
Yes.
That's the way I'd want to pursue it. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to want to try to put my own spin on it, but I don't think that spin, that is distortive rhetorical twisting. I'm trying to help people see it for what it is. Our concern with regards, and this is why people up until it got politically incorrect, people in the business of psychology thought this is gender confusion. They have the desires of a woman, though they have a man's body. That's confusion. But what could be plainer? Well, now, why, you want to say confusion is good? You want me to say that homosexuality is just fine? Well, no, I can't say that. So I don't know. There is no trick way out of that. You know, there's no guaranteed one-liner that everybody's going to stand up and applaud for you, especially in that venue. I guarantee you that. People were nice to me when I was there. But still, it's a rough crowd to deal with. So, listen, Paul, I gotta run. I got another caller here I got to get to, okay?
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, another P. It's Peter. Hello, Peter. Welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hello, Greg.
Yes, we got you.
All right. So, my child is getting to the point where he's a toddler now. My wife has been nursing him since he was born.
Uh-huh.
She has produced more breast milk than was necessary. We have a bunch of it kind of sitting in the freezer.
Uh-huh.
And my wife wants to continue she pumps also. So it's sort of like, you know, she feeds directly and pumps so we can have
right.
for later.
Right. Right.
And so she figures it's not that big. It's not that much of a, problem. It's not that inconvenient for her, so she would like to continue pumping and donate her breast milk to a foster child.
Uh-huh.
So that was something that she had been considering, and then based on that feeling, she was discussing it with one of her coworkers, and I guess through a series of events, she's not sure how it kind of ended up this way, she kind of half agreed to provide, to donate her breast milk directly to a foster child that her coworker, who's in a same-sex marriage,
mm-hmm.
Are trying to adopt. They don't have the child yet, but it seems this person, this man, is under the impression now that she's agreed to provide breast milk for their baby if they mm-hmm. if they adopt the baby. So I was wondering first, what are your what do you think morally of the idea of donating breast milk in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And second, since we don't think that same-sex unions are actually marriages and we basically agree with you on all on those points.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to donate to breast milk to this foster child without compromising that point of view?
Let me two separate questions, and they're fair ones. I cannot imagine what would be morally questionable about a mother who has completed nursing her child, who continues to produce milk, to continue doing that to provide milk for another child. You know, they used to be part of our culture. They were called wet nurses. Now, they directly nursed for the mother. They were lactating women. I don't know the circumstances that initiated the lactation. Maybe they had their own children. And then as long as nursing continues, my suspicion is then the mother will continue to lactate. So it doesn't matter which child she's nursing, hers or someone else's, then she'll continue to lactate. That was the wet nurse concept, I'm pretty sure. And so whether the mother who has the capability of giving milk, gives the milk, delivers it directly or through a bottle or something like that, to me that is irrelevant. If wet nursing is morally acceptable, and I see no reason to think that it is not, then providing that same milk to a child through another means is not morally objectionable either. But this does raise another question about whether the child is the child of a potential same-sex union. So let me ask you a question. Let's take this child. Let's say that this child in question that would maybe receive the milk would receive some other food from you. Would it be legitimate for you to feed a child who is hungry that had, say, that the child had been produced through a rape? The child's the circumstances surrounding the child's need is irrelevant to whether or not you feed the child. So if you give the child mother's milk or oatmeal, doesn't matter what the circumstance is. You're there to feed the child. You are not acting to support a relationship that maybe you don't think is right. They're entirely different things. So I give a thumbs up on both of those options. All right. All right, friends, that's all the time we have. Thank you for joining me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. And no callers this hour. I want to spend it devoted to conversation with one of my favorite people, Stephen C. Meyer. He's the author of Signature in the Cell, got his PhD from University of Cambridge in philosophy of science, founder and director for the Center for Science and Culture Discovery Institute. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, but he's just a great guy to have in your corner when it comes to the whole debate about science and religion, particularly as it relates to the issue of Darwinian evolution. Steve, it's great to talk with you again.
It's always good to talk with you, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. You know, we get to chat once, you know, now and again just by ourselves, and we have such great conversations on the phone as I'm taking long drives or whatever, or maybe we bang into each other at some event, and I'm always wishing that our audience could kind of be listening over our shoulders because it's so much fun. So we get to do that a little bit today. I have in front of me, this is totally unrelated to our conversation, but I have a set of notes that I discovered on my computer, Steve, that was from January, February, March 21st, 1994, when you were at Talbot giving a lecture. And I think this is one of the first time. Now, we had met actually before this, I think, you know, because you came and did something at my church for me. But this was the first talk where you were talking really about the ID stuff. Demarcation and Design was the name of the talk. And Melinda and I were in that classroom, and I mentioned this to her. I said, look at these notes. They were on my computer. You know, I just typed in Meyer, you know, trying to find what I had on you, and there these notes popped up. And it was amazing.
You're making me feel old.
Well, the thing that stands out for me about that particular talk, and I think I've mentioned this to you, but I'm going to mention it to the audience because it's a great point. You were talking about information, and you held up a sheet of paper, your notes or something, and you said, I could know everything about this sheet of paper physically speaking. I could know it exhaustively. I could know it omnisciently, all the things about the paper and the ink and the size and the weight and all of that, but I would never know what it says. And that was such a cogent way of conveying to me as your student at that time, as a young, brand-new MA in philosophy student there at Talbot, about the role of information in the unseen world. And of course, your whole career has been built on this, at least your popular career, the one that most people know about, has been built on the whole issue of information and the Darwinian project.
Well, it really is the crucial issue in all these debates about biological origins, mm-hmm. because we have come to realize that information essentially in a digital form, as it's stored on the DNA molecule, mm-hmm. is running the show inside living cells. It's directing the construction of all the proteins and protein machines that cells need to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of, in a way, ironic or just intriguing that at just the time in the history of human technology that we are developing information-based technologies, the ability to store and transmit information in mm-hmm. digital form in a computer environment, we have discovered that the same kind of technology has long pre-existed us in every cell of every living organism. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of the information age, which we use as a metaphor to describe our own technological environment, is now in some strange way applicable to life as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and you have been leveraging that point successfully for 20 years. I guess I did. It didn't. The change didn't fall into the meter for me until just recently, that you are not just a significant player at the Discovery Institute, the Center for Science and Culture, but you were actually one of the founding fathers of that enterprise.
Well, I had a chance when I was still a young professor at Whitworth in Spokane mm-hmm. to develop a proposal for a program at the Discovery Institute with my colleague John West, who's the associate director of the program and a very fine scholar in his own right. What we were recognized at the time was that there was a tremendous collection of really talented great institutions, the top places, who were collectively skeptical about the neo-Darwinian project and the whole materialistic evolutionary approach to understanding life's origins. And one by one, these members of this now group were getting to know each other and know about each other, and it kind of dawned on everyone that, you know, we weren't supposed to exist. And there were guys that had done PhDs at University of Chicago, and people who had done PhDs at Caltech and in Cambridge and Oxford and Harvard, and it was just kind of a shocking realization that to each person that we weren't alone in our doubts about Darwinian evolution. And so the idea at Discovery was that what if we raise some money and put some research dollars behind some of this talent, and what would happen? And, you know, books like The Design Inference by William Dembski and Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe and others started to come forward to define the intelligent design position, and it's just kind of continued from strength to strength type of basis since then. Since we started the program in 1996, we've had about 120 books written by this, the scientists and scholars associated with the Center for Science and Culture, and 12 to or so documentary films, and there's been science education policies have been changed in 9 or 10 states as a result of efforts of the people who work with the center. So it's been a really it's been an amazing run, and it's been a great privilege to be affiliated with so many really talented people who are convinced that the materialist view of reality is almost certainly false, as one scholar put it recently.
To paraphrase the subtitle of an atheist scholar's recent book, Mind and Cosmos.
Yeah, I wondered why that phrase tumbled off the tongue, but yeah, that's a great story, actually. Thomas Nagel, who made the mistake of commending one of our books in 2009, and then he was kind of hammered by his atheist brethren, and that we thought he'd had enough, and then in 2012 he came out with his own book called Mind and Cosmos, subtitle, How the Neo-Darwinian View, Materialist View of Reality is Almost Certainly False.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice something else in the title, though? That is, his last clause there, Almost Certainly False, is almost exact copy of the conclusion of Richard Dawkins' argument in The God Delusion, but he says that the idea that God exists is almost certainly false.
Oh, I didn't realize there was that parallel.
Yeah,
so he had an ironic twist to his...
Yes, I think there was a little poke in the eye there at Richard. I'm not sure.
Well,
but
that's well-deserved, I'd have to say. Yeah,
because Richard's been poking people in the eye for a long time.
Well, also, his arguments are just so awful. Mm-hmm. They're really bad. You know, he writes this whole book called The God Delusion, which is premised on the idea that the design argument has failed, and he thinks the design argument was the best argument for the existence of God because it was premised on publicly accessible evidence, and he may have a point there, but he said since Darwin, we've known that there is no evidence of design, only the appearance of design. And the appearance of design, we think, is only an appearance because we think that natural selection and random mutation have the power to mimic a designing intelligence. But in making that argument, he doesn't deal with any of the really up-to-date arguments for design, including the argument from information in living cells.
Right. So, you know, I thought for our conversation here, there's a couple of things that I want to accomplish.
Sure.
Two things, generally, that will probably range over a number of things. I do want to get an update from you in just a bit. In layman's terms, on the state of the ID debate versus the materialist Darwinian point of view. And this is something we always talk about, and this is significant part of your writing as you move along, and you have the signature in the cell, which is I consider your magnum opus. But you weren't resting on your laurels. You published since then. I've got Darwin's Doubt next to me, that advances more of these arguments. And then I want to talk a little bit about the debates that you're having with the theistic evolutionists. So you know, there's a lot of things that are happening right now, and I want to bring people up to date. But I'm also aware that a lot of our listeners maybe don't have their feet firmly planted in an understanding of ID and how that approach works. And so maybe you can just, you've already laid out a little bit just talking about the history with the Discovery Institute. Can you talk a little bit more about the information and intelligent design and just how the model works? And one thing that I wanted to mention about all of the books that you said, over 100 that have been published, is I want people to understand that these are not books that are exegeting scripture. That is not the approach at all that you're taking. These are scientific books that are inferring design from the scientific evidence. And so if you can cast that out a little bit in a foundational way, and then we'll start talking about, what's been happening lately in both the secularist front and the religious Darwinist front of the theistic evolutionists.
Yeah, you bet. That's a great outline. Let's start with just maybe defining intelligent design. The theory of intelligent design asserts that there are certain features of life and of the universe that are best explained by reference to an intelligent cause, a mind, rather than an undirected material process, such as, for example, the Darwinian idea of natural selection acting on random mutations. Mm-hmm. And one of the best ways to understand intelligent design is to understand it in contrast to the idea that it was specifically formulated to challenge. The idea or term evolution can mean lots of different things. It can mean change over time. It can mean continuous change over time, as depicted by Darwin's branching tree of life, picture of the history of life, which is another way of thinking about his idea of universal common descent. Mm-hmm. And it can also mean the idea that there's an unguided, undirected material process, such as natural selection and random mutation, mm-hmm. that has the power to produce all the forms of life we see today, including the appearance of design that those forms of life manifest. So the third meaning of evolution is the idea that design is essentially an illusion. It was produced by an unguided, undirected process. So we have design without a designer, the appearance of design mm-hmm. produced by an unguided, undirected process. And that's the meaning of evolution, that intelligent design is challenging. Mm-hmm. And we think that there's lots of evidence of actual design, both in the cosmos and in living systems. And in living systems and biology, in the area that I work, it's really the evidence for design is really exquisite. Mm-hmm. What we're finding inside cells, which were thought to be extremely simple entities back in the 19th century at the time when Darwin formulated his theory, is that cells are actually immensely complex. There's an integrated form of complexity everywhere evident in cells. We have miniature machines, nanotechnology. We have DNA molecules chock full of digital code, code that in fact provides instructions for directing the production of these complex machines made of proteins. And overall, you have something like an integrated chemical factory, all on a miniaturized scale.
You know, when you mention that, I think of the incredible graphics in the one of the first DVDs that you guys were involved with. I think it's called Unlocking the Mystery of Life. Is that it?
Right. Unlocking the Mystery of Life has a lovely animation in it of what's called the gene expression system, which is essentially how the digital code in the DNA directs the construction of the protein and protein machines mm-hmm. that cells need to stay alive.
Yeah.
So inside living cells, you've got digital codes stored in DNA molecules, you have a complex information processing system, you have circuitry, networks of cells, or networks of genes, rather, that are forming integrated circuits that control the expression of other genes, and advanced forms of nanotechnology, little miniature machines, rotary engines, sliding clamps, robotic walking motor proteins that that drag vesicles of material along essentially a railroad track type.
It's a little city in operation.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
All
and,
of it.
And it's be made more visual, obviously, in this Unlocking the Mystery of Life, which does also include some of what you talked about earlier, that is the history of the development of this movement. And we recommend it all the time because it really gives people a visual where visuals are needed. It's hard to, I think, understand this complexity that you're describing. Once you see it happening, you see a small metropolis, well, small because it's microscopic, but it's a complex metropolis that's operating in all those ways that you described. And these things reproduce themselves sometimes every 20 minutes, you know?
Oh, incredibly rapid rates. The information processing is just incredible. One other thing that would help for your listeners to visualize this is to go to my website, darwinsdoubt.com, the website for the current book.
Mm-hmm.
Also has a YouTube channel on it with interviews and debates, but also a playlist of animations, one of which is called Journey Inside the Cell, which I highly recommend to your listeners. They can go in two and a half minutes and get a really clear visual depiction of what we're talking about as to how the information stored along the spine of the DNA molecule is used to direct the construction of these protein parts. One analogy that might help is what happens up here at the Boeing plant in Seattle. We're famous in Seattle for Microsoft, which writes code, and Boeing, which uses code to direct the construction of airplanes. It's a technology called CAD/CAM, computer-assisted design and manufacture.
Mm-hmm.
And engineers will write code. They'll sit at their console, write the code. It will be direct the construction of an airplane wing. The code will be translated into another machine language, which will then direct the construction of the airplane wing. It may direct a manufacturing arm to place the rivets in very specific places in accord with the engineer's instructions. And something very like that is taking place inside living cells where digital code is directing the construction of mechanical parts. It's really exquisite.
Let me ask you just to clarify one other point, because as you mentioned defining evolution, there are a couple of different things or more than that on the table. Maybe one way of looking at it is there is a mechanism on the table, which is, let's say, mutation and natural selection. So this is a mechanistic process. But you identified something else that's really important. I think there's a little controversy even about this, but that evolution is an unguided, undirected process, as one person put it, that did not have us in mind, famously put it. But this I think is an important part. I know in some discussions, some people want to argue that evolution itself does not entail the idea that it is unguided, undirected process. But it just strikes me that the rank and file practitioner of science in these areas and the people who are the main spokesman virtually always characterize it this way, and that if you say otherwise, like you say, okay, but there's a designer somehow operating this mechanism that you're describing, that's when they say, wait, you don't understand what evolution is if you're inferring a designer at any point, because an essential part of our program here is that it is unguided and undirected, and if you infer a designer anywhere in the process, then you're breaking that sine qua non of Darwinian evolution.
Well, right. This is really hard-baked into the logic of Darwin's argument in The Origin of Species, and it's important to understand this. What Darwin was trying to do was explain the origin of the appearance of design. It was a big part of what he was up to.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this in the third chapter of The Origin in particular, where it tries to show that natural selection and random mutation, or, well, he would have at that time called it random variation.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know about mutation.
Right.
But the natural selection mechanism explains the adaptation of organisms to their environment, which had previously been thought by 19th century biologists to be the best evidence of design, of intelligent design.
Mm-hmm.
Every organism is fish live in water. They've got gills and swim bladders and they're well adapted to their environment.
Well, one would probably want to say designed would be the obvious way. They're not just, in a sense, accidentally adapted. They are made for or fit for that environment. Is what
right,
you're right,
right? Okay. And that was the 19th century. That was the one of the best arguments for design in the 19th mm-hmm. century. And Darwin said, "Well, I can explain that." Mm-hmm. And I use an example in my book. It wasn't one that he used, but he used lots of examples like this. My example is of sheep in the far north of Scotland. And if you want to get a woolier breed of sheep, what do you do? Well, sheep herders have known for centuries that if you breed the wooliest males and the wooliest ewes and let them have offspring, then lo and behold, they're going to be offspring in that. They're going to be a little bit woolier. And mm-hmm. if you repeat that process generation after generation after generation, you can eventually breed a woolier breed of sheep.
Right.
And Darwin, in effect, said, well, nature can accomplish the same end. Mm-hmm. If, for example, we imagined a series of very cold winters such that only the wooliest males and females survive, mm-hmm. then again, you'd get a woolier set of offspring.
Kind of a selective breeding, right.
Mm-hmm. So what Darwin wanted to do was devise a mechanism that could produce a greater adaptation to the environment without involving an intelligent agent. Mm-hmm. So the mechanism of natural selection was devised to displace the role of intelligent design in producing adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, in a sense, a designer substitute mechanism. Now, the question in 20th century biology is this. Are these minor adaptations, you know, woolier sheep in cold climate or Galapagos finches with shorter or longer beaks in mm-hmm. response to varying weather patterns, are the kinds of adaptations we see natural selection producing the only appearance of design? And if not, has natural selection and random mutation, the modern neo-Darwinian mechanism, explained away all those other appearances of design?
Right.
And that's where the positive argument for intelligent design comes in, because mm-hmm. we want to say, first of all, no, natural selection and random mutation haven't explained away all the most striking evidences of design,
right.
In particular, the miniature machines and the circuitry and the digital code inside cells. And secondly, there is a cause of which we know that can explain those kinds of effects,
mm-hmm.
and that cause is intelligent agency. In fact, my argument centers on the importance of information, and what we know from experience is that whenever we see information and we trace it back to its source, especially when we find it in a digital or alphabetic form, whether we're talking about information in a computer program or a hieroglyphic inscription on the Rosetta Stone, mm-hmm. or information embedded in a radio signal or information in a paragraph or book, whenever we see information and we trace it back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. So the discovery that information lies at the foundation of living systems, that is actually running the show inside cells, is a powerful indicator of the prior activity of a designing intelligence,
mm-hmm.
because we know of no other cause that produces that kind of effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the key arguments for intelligent design.
Yeah, the discovery of information, to me, has the impact on the teleological or design argument similar to the discovery of the Big Bang and the cosmological argument, at least one,
absolutely.
One
in both
form
cases,
of it.
The new scientific discoveries revive these ancient arguments.
That's right. Okay, we got to go to break here. My guest, Stephen Meyer, author of Signature in the Cell, and more recently, Darwin's Doubt, and maybe he's working on something, too, he'll tell us about. But we're going to get back, having laid the foundation here and finding out what it actually is, the new stuff that's going on, and how are the arguments faring right now in the field. Lots to talk about there here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market, and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All right, Greg Kokel here with you and my guest and friend and colleague, Dr. Stephen Meyer, Signature in the Cell, Darwin's Doubt. Many of you know him from the Discovery Institute and his talks and debates and writings. Stephen, we've kind of laid a foundation now of the critical role of understanding information, especially kind of in a digital or
alphabetic or typographic
form is exactly what we have in the cell. I appreciated also how you emphasized that the notion that the development of life is an unguided, undirected process is kind of hard-baked into Darwinism from Darwin himself, because this issue, we're going to revisit this a little bit later when we talk about theistic evolution. But there have been things that you've been involved with, obviously, all the time here in this ongoing debate. You're in the crosshairs of both the secular Darwinists and now the religious Darwinists, the theistic evolutionist crowd, the biologos crowd, etc. Let's talk a little bit about the secular Darwinists, because as we were talking a few months ago, you were talking about new developments that are happening and new engagements you're having and new information that is shedding more doubt on the neo-Darwinian synthesis and also at the same time buttressing the arguments for intelligent design. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Maybe I could just update you on the reception of the arguments that I've made, in particular the argument of Darwin's Doubt. Darwin's Doubt concerns an event in the history of life known as the Cambrian Explosion, which is the event in which the major groups of organisms or the major groups of animals first arise in the fossil record. And I show in the book that to account for all that new animal form, you need, again, vast amounts of new information, mm-hmm. and argue that the events like the Cambrian Explosion, in which there's a clear and evident infusion of a huge amount of new information into the biosphere, provide evidence for the activity of a designing intelligence in the history of life, mm-hmm. again, because we know of no other cause for the origin of information apart from intelligent agency. Mm-hmm. Now, the book came out last year in June, and it was there were a number of reviews initially, and there were ones that were friendly and ones that were unfriendly. The critical reviews were by and large completely avoided the main argument of the book. They mm-hmm. didn't address the question of the origin of information, so they were essentially nitpicking about little points of paleontology or things like mm-hmm. that. There was, though, a review in Science, the largest science publication in the United States, in September, and it was a negative review, but it was respectful, and it was written by a very leading Cambridge paleontologist and evolutionary biologist named Charles Marshall, who is at University of California, Berkeley, mm-hmm. and he said a few nice things about the book, but he had an overall negative verdict. But what was really encouraging to me was he attempted to take on the information argument. And he mm-hmm. said, look, Meyer claims that you need a lot of new information, genetic information, to build these Cambrian animals. He said, but that's not our current understanding. Our current understanding is that all that would have had to take place is for the evolutionary process would have just needed to rewire the genetic regulatory networks that control the expression of pre-existing genes. Now, that sounded, it was very elegantly stated the way he put it, but as I read that carefully and then broke it down, I thought, this is really a quite extraordinarily revealing response, because rewiring a genetic regulatory network is a network of genes that are functioning in something like an integrated circuit. But each one of the genes in the network is a gene full of genetic information. And so he's presupposing the existence of all that information in the genetic regulatory network.
To begin with.
To begin with. Then he says it would need to be rewired by the evolutionary process, but rewiring a system of genes requires multiple coordinated changes in the digital code in each of the genes, and that's an additional input of information. Again, presupposed but not explained. And then thirdly, those genetic regulatory networks act on pre-existing genes for building the parts of various, say, Cambrian animals, and that's a third source of genetic information, which he presupposed but did not explain.
Wait, explain that third step one more time to me. I missed it.
Well,
I mean, I heard it, but I wasn't
genetic regulatory networks control how other genes are expressed during the process of animal development.
Okay.
And so to get a full picture of how an animal develops, you need the regulatory networks, you need other genes for building essentially the parts list, and then Marshall was arguing you'd need to get a new developmental gene regulatory network so you could develop a new animal, you'd need to rewire these developmental gene regulatory networks. So you've got changes in code in pre-existing genes operating on other genes.
Let me put it this way and tell me if I got it. You need new machines and you need new management.
Something like that, or just the simplest way to think of it is that in order to explain information, the origin of information, you have to presuppose other information.
Yes, that's the problem
and
here.
And so he's just, you know, in other words, you don't need a PhD in biology to see what's wrong with this attempt to answer the argument.
Right.
It's basically begging the question.
Right.
A basic logic, informal fallacy in logic. And what was really encouraging to me was, first of all, that he had taken the time to review the book, that it was respectful, that it was written in science, but that he had tried to take on the argument and in so doing had revealed just how weak the case actually is. And then Marshall and I had an hour and a half debate on British radio where we discussed these same issues at greater length, and it was really a terrific conversation, and I think he's really grappling with the issues in a way that some of the other reviewers and many of the other people in the Darwinian establishment aren't.
So what was the basic in this debate with him, and I can imagine how refreshing it must have been to dialogue with a colleague who was up to the task scientifically and philosophically, and who stayed on topic, so to speak, and did not follow rabbit trails. What was the upshot of that in the public's mind, or was he himself saying, you know, you got some good points here, and we're not sure exactly how to deal with this, or how did that play out?
It was a really interesting conversation, and it's actually available on my website, so people can go and listen to it for themselves. And I made the point that I just made to you in kind of my opening salvo, and Marshall, at one point, it was describing, he was claiming that there are self-organizational processes that can help explain the origin of biological form. But I had watched a lecture that he had done at Harvard in which he had described these self-organizational processes. But in his own lecture, he made very clear that they only ensue after, they ensue as the result of lots and lots of other pre-existing genes. So once you've got a lot of genetic information in place, then there are patterns of development that are kind of recurrent that suggest that there's a pre-programming that causes the subsequent organization.
Right.
So, and I pointed that out to him, and he said that was a fair comment.
Wow. So it's like you're saying, you know, there's a machine. How did that machine get made? Well, that machine was made by another machine.
Yeah, you don't need a baker to explain the origin of the bread. You've got a bread-making machine.
but
the bread-making machine was made by a bread-making machine engineer, you know?
Yes, right, exactly.
So you end up with this type of problem in trying to explain. Information is so foundational to life. I mean, I used to ask my students, you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And they would say, well, code, you know, information, software. The same thing is true in life. If you want to build a new form of life from a simpler pre-existing form, you have to have new information. Mm-hmm. And that has turned out to be the very difficult thing for the mutation natural selection mechanism to account for, and that's essentially the problem.
Well, the reason I think that this is so exciting is because you write a book that raises an issue, and it's a legitimate issue, and the other side pushes back with a bunch of nonsense. But one person wants to try to play fair and does a write-up in Science, but then in his write-up, it essentially affirms your view by trying to explain it away by presuming the need for information to begin with. So
yeah, and
if that's
clear,
the best he can do.
He didn't mean to affirm my view, but
no.
my perspective on what he said is that he inadvertently revealed the weakness of the Darwinian position, mm-hmm. its inability to explain the origin of information, apart from this illicit move of presupposing it,
mm-hmm.
which is another way of confirming that there is no adequate cause for the origin of information apart from intelligence,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
apart from mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if people would like to learn more about this, that I've just come out with a paperback version of Darwin's Doubt, and the publisher very kindly allowed me to write an additional chapter, an epilogue, in which I got to respond to the main scientific critics of the book. And there were three main criticisms, and the most important one was Marshall's critique, and my response to him is written up there, and people can mm-hmm. have a look and really weigh the arguments on both sides for themselves.
Well, you know, you mentioned something in Darwin's Doubt about the Altenburg 16, and I actually read a piece today by Massimo Piglucci, who's one of the 16, and I wonder if you could mention something about what that is, and I have some questions I want to ask you about.
Well, right. I mean, one of the themes of the book is that there is a huge disparity between the public presentation of Darwinian theory in textbooks and by people like Richard Dawkins and Eugenie Scott with her National Center for Science Education up in Oakland, the New York Times science writers. The public spokesman for Darwinism presented as a theory about which there is no controversy.
Yeah.
And there's a huge disparity between that presentation of the theory and the presentation of the theory as you find it in the peer-reviewed scientific literature, including the literature in the field of evolutionary biology. Charles Marshall himself, who I regard as one of the really top Cambrian paleontologists in the world, has been openly skeptical about neo-Darwinism since the late 80s.
Huh.
And he's trying to come up with other evolutionary models to account for the key problematic elements. But the main problem that many evolutionary theorists have acknowledged is that the mechanism of mutation and natural selection has very limited creative power.
Mm-hmm.
One evolutionary biologist says that mutation and selection explains the survival, but not the arrival of the fittest.
Mm-hmm.
It explains the small-scale variations, changes in the frequency of dark versus light-colored moths in the famed peppered moths in England.
Uh-huh.
The changes in the Galapagos finch beaks,
right.
the adaptation of bacteria to antibiotics, etc. But it doesn't explain where we get moths or sheep
mm-hmm.
or finches or animals, indeed, animals in the first place.
Yeah, that's a significant admission because this particular point has been made by people like you for a long time.
Well, in a way,
if natural selection,
I started making it because I was reading it in the literature, you know, from the evolutionary biologists themselves. So there's a big disparity between what the popularizers are saying, what the textbook writers are saying,
mm-hmm.
and what the leading people in the field are saying. And as a result of that, many, many evolutionary theorists are now trying to formulate new models, new theories, come up with new mechanisms. And some are even openly calling for a new theory of evolution,
mm-hmm.
members of the Altenburg 16 group are among those folks. This is a group of evolutionary biologists who met in the European city of Altenburg in, I think it was 2010,
mm-hmm.
sometime around there, and they were exploring new approaches to evolutionary theory because they recognized the problems with the standard neo-Darwinian model. And in Darwin's Doubt, I have a couple of chapters where I describe each of these new models or new theories of evolution that have been proposed, and there's about six of them. And there's a couple reasons I wanted to talk about these. One, the very fact of these models shows that not all is well in the house of Darwinian theory.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I evaluated each one of them very carefully to show that they, too, fail to explain the origin of genetic information.
Mm-hmm.
One of the models, or new theories of evolution, is one that I think has a lot of merit to it. It's something called natural genetic engineering. And it's advanced by a brilliant cell biologist at the University of Chicago named James Shapiro.
Mm-hmm.
And Shapiro shows that the mutations that occur in living organisms are not generally random, as the Darwinians say, but in fact are usually goal-directed by a kind of pre-programmed adaptive capacity. Essentially, the cell or the organism has the capacity to respond to various kinds of environmental stresses, and then it will generate mutations in a kind of directed way to try to solve certain problems.
Huh.
Well, that's really a cool new insight into how life works and how it's able to respond to environmental changes. But it begs a really important question. Where does all that pre-programming come from?
Right.
So there is evolution taking place in response to environmental changes, but it's within the context of pre-programmed adaptive capacity, which I would argue is additional evidence of design, and you would see in that pre-programmed capacity is the locus of design in the organism.
Let me ask you a question. Is he just explaining a way this could take place, but it entails another element of design, or is he identifying things that are actually happening that can be properly called evolution, though it's not mutation, natural selection in the standard sense? It's this new mechanism which itself requires some design element.
It's more the latter. He's describing these processes
that I think
can be rightly called as evolutionary, in that they do cause organisms to change over time.
Mm-hmm.
But they are occurring because of pre-programmed adaptive capacity in the genome. He says that a lot of this is under algorithmic control. Well, algorithms are things we know from our experience are produced by intelligent agents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's kind of it's pre-programmed adaptive capacity that allows organisms to adapt and change and evolve in that sense.
In some measure.
So there's a sense in which there's evolution going on, but it's designed.
Evolution,
The ability to do so is designed.
Right, right. The machine that makes the machine is a design machine. We're
right.
Kind of back to that again. So would this be an example of microevolution, that there is evolutionary capability within limits that is designed into the creature, but it is within limits? Or?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's within the limits of the pre-existing genome and the algorithmic control of that genome, which we may not entirely understand at this place as to where exactly that's located.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, it's a great new development in theoretical and evolutionary biology, but it doesn't really solve the fundamental problem of the origin of information.
Right,
and that's so in highlighting these new theories, I wanted to give these guys due because there's some really interesting developments in the field. B, I wanted to show that neo-Darwinism is really long past its pull date.
Mm-hmm.
And C, I wanted to show that the argument for design still holds, that even these theories that have merit are presupposing rather than explaining the information that's needed to make these fantastically intricate processes happen.
Yeah, when I come back, I want to talk a little bit more about a pushback from their side regarding the Altenburg 60 and see what you have to say about it. And then I want to ask you about some of your discussions with the theistic evolutionists.
You bet.
Okay, I'm talking with Stephen Meyer, author of Darwin's Doubt. It's just being released now as a paperback, and it's been updated. You'll want to take a look at that. We'll have that posted on Twitter and also on our website blog tomorrow. I'm Greg Cole. This is Stand to Reason. Stay with us for our final segment.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians, just like you, will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study The Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order The Bible Fast Forward.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel with Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute, Darwin's Doubt, Signature in the Cell, etc. Stephen, you did a fabulous job on the True You stuff that Focus on the Family put out. I just want to mention that because we provide that here at Stand to Reason. A number of segments, what, 5 or 6, 7 segments per class, so to speak, True You 1 and True You 2. You did one on the existence
of God.
Actually,
yeah, there are 10 short 25-minute lectures in each series, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're exceptionally capable of communicating complex ideas in a way that's accessible. You do a great job in those classes, so I want to recommend that material to folks. Steve does a little bit of kind of a mini classroom session, but talks about great arguments for the existence of God and the authority of Scripture. Really fascinating stuff. So Altenburg 16, I read a piece, actually it's probably a couple years ago now, by Massimo, I hope I don't butcher his name.
Massimo Pigliucci, yeah.
There you go. Thank you so much for rescuing me there. Here is what his pushback on the way that I think you and some other ID folks have used the Altenburg 16 is he's trying to downplay the controversy that there is a fundamental scientific disagreement about evolutionary theory, but what he wants to do is say, look, well, there was Darwin, and then you have neo-Darwinism, so you got a little adjustment where mutations brought in with natural selection, and now that was like Darwin 2.0, and now we got Darwin 3.0. We're just making adjustments, but we still believe in evolution. Now, it strikes me that this is like keeping the sound of the word, but kind of retooling something so much that it's something very different. You know, I might be mistaken on this, but it
really isn't a refutation of anything that I've written or the argument from design that I'm advancing. Because remember, evolution can mean many things. It can mean change over time. It can mean universal common descent. The universal common ancestry thesis, and it can mean that the mechanism of mutation and natural selection have the capacity to produce all the form and the appearance of design that we see. Mm-hmm. What all the proponents of these new theories of evolution would affirm the first two meanings, and they're looking for some additional mechanisms that have more creative power than mutation and selection to supplement compensate the gap in explanatory power in neo-Darwinian theory, which does rely on mutation and selection exclusively. Mm-hmm. And so, I'd encourage your listeners who are interested in this to dig into the chapters I do on this in Darwin's Doubt, because I actually show that each of the different theories will affirm different elements of the mutation selection mechanism and then try to supplement it with something else. Mm-hmm. And all that's fair and well and good. The point that I make, though, in the book is that none of these new theories provides a mechanism that accounts for the origin of information.
Information, which is that's the key thing. But it is fair, I think, if what they're doing is trying to round out the picture here, it is because mutation and natural selection, which is neo-Darwinism, is not adequate.
It's not adequate, and they are acknowledging that. And and some will say, well, this is the extended synthesis. And others will say, well, we're coming up with a new theory of evolution. And it's really a semantic difference. In both cases, they're trying to add something to the theory to compensate for the inefficacy, the lack of creative power associated with natural selection and random mutations.
So what turns out to be the same is kind of the underlying materialistic commitment, but the picture of the thing itself is changing significantly.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that's the typical rhetorical move. You criticize Darwinian evolution. You point out that other people have criticized it who are working within the field, and they say, well, that's not fair because we still accept evolution, by which they really mean we're committed
to a materialistic.
Under all circumstances, to accepting some kind of materialistic evolutionary account of how things came about, even if we can't any longer rely on natural selection and random mutation. But that's really more a statement of their underlying philosophical commitments than it is an affirmation of any adequate theory or mechanism of evolutionary change.
Right. We got about 5 minutes left, and I do want to touch on something you mentioned to me in one of our recent phone conversations, and that was that a lot of the work you're doing now is debating theistic evolutionists, people who are basically advancing the whole neo-Darwinian synthesis as something God used, and do you want to talk about that
a little bit? Well, yeah, I have a couple of things to say about that. I did have a big debate with a theistic evolutionist who helped form the BioLogos program with Francis Collins. His name is Carl Giberson. And partly because of what we were just talking about, how you have secular evolutionary biologists recognizing that neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory is inadequate, that the mutation selection mechanism lacks creative power. It seems to me a very odd time to have such a huge push in the religious world to, in effect, baptize the Darwinian way of thinking and say this is the way that God created the world. If the mutation natural selection mechanism lacks creative power, then saying that God used that mechanism makes absolutely no sense at all. And secondly, I think there's just some really problematic theological and conceptual problems associated with the theistic evolutionary program. We've been calling on the theistic evolutionists to clarify what they mean by evolution. Do they mean simply change over time? Do they mean common ancestry? Or do they mean the idea that natural selection and random mutation, the unguided process of mutation and selection, is sufficient to produce all forms of life? By evolution, do they mean a guided or an unguided process? And almost all the current theistic evolutionists have been famously vague about exactly what they mean there. They've been really reluctant to clarify. And I think there's a reason for that, because there's a kind of dilemma that confronts their position. If they mean that the mechanism of evolution is a guided process, something that God is actively guiding, well, that's a form of intelligent design.
Right.
But all the theistic evolutionists who are prominent in the debate have been very explicit in rejecting the theory of intelligent design. So they have been, you know, so that option is kind of off the table for them. But at the same time, they don't want to say that it's undirected, because any theologian worth his salt will realize that if the mechanism is really unguided, then it's not really clear what God is doing in creation, in which case they're affirming a position that is indistinguishable from deism.
Right.
And in my debate with Giberson, he actually admitted that that was a weakness of his position. So you either have a logical problem of God guiding an unguided process, which is nonsensical, or you have a theological problem in which you are affirming that really nature is doing this all on its own, and God is doing little more than just existing, which is kind of a form of deism.
Yeah, it's a substandard view of God.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
At that particular point. Well, I think it's telling. I listened, and I mentioned this to you when I was in ETS in the fall, that I sat in on a session with Dennis Lamoureux, who is an ardent advancer of evolution or the theistic evolution, but the idea that there was no Adam. I mean, he's taking it all that far, and there are all other problems with this. But one thing that stood out, though, is that he is concerned, and I know that Francis Collins has expressed this, that unless you accept the Darwinian model, then Christianity will not seem credible to outsiders.
Their argument is not based on substance. They don't give arguments for the creative power of natural selection and random mutation. In fact, in my debate with Carl Giberson, I made four separate scientific arguments against the creative power of mutation selection, arguments that reflect things that are going on in the peer-reviewed literature in evolutionary biology. And he made no attempt to rebut those arguments. Rather, the way the theistic evolutionists typically argue is essentially a consequentialist argument that says, if we don't accept Darwinian evolution, we're going to bring disrepute to the faith. We're going to show that it lacks intellectual credibility. But I think that's incredibly ironic, because we're at just that point in the development of evolutionary biology as a discipline where many leading theorists are acknowledging that neo-Darwinism is dead. Now, the theistic evolutionists I know aren't saying, yeah, it's dead, but we're supplementing it with these new theories of evolution. They're not saying that. They're just endorsing the standard theory and saying Christians need to accept it. And I think that's a very odd move to make at just the point that secular evolutionary biologists are rejecting the neo-Darwinian synthesis in droves.
I agree, but I think it's worse than that, because the only kind of evolution that is going to be acceptable to the other side is an evolution that is unguided and undirected.
Absolutely. In fact, what really, in the end, all the theistic evolution comes down to is a kind of generalized affirmation that somehow God is working through some kind of natural causes or secondary causes without really specifying what those causes or mechanisms are.
Yeah, never mind the damage this is doing theologically with regards to the fall and the Adam question and original innocence, which Lamoureux told me when I asked him about it, he said, doesn't matter whether there's any time of original innocence. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. Oh, my goodness. Christian theology hangs upon that.
Well, the theistic evolutionists typically will say, we didn't fall into sin, we fell up into consciousness. And I'll leave it to you to explain the theological problems associated with taking that position. But it's bad science. It's incoherent, I think, as a proposal, because they haven't been able to specify exactly what God is doing in the, if anything, in the process of creation. And it raises all kinds of theological problems. Because one by one, it eats away at the various doctrines.
Yeah, and I wrote a piece last year, I think, called Drifting Towards Darwin, identifying some of these problems. People can find that at str.org. But this was my concern. You know, we're losing the foundation when we drift towards Darwin, because the only kind of Darwinism that that the other side is going to accept from us is one that eviscerates our worldview, and that's not going to help anything. So, Stephen, we're all out of time. It has been fabulous talking with you, as usual. Thanks for spending an hour with us, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, we packed a lot in an hour. It was a great conversation. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Keep up the good work there.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks. Darwin's Doubt and Signature in the Cell, those are starters. You can catch True You, the first two sessions with Stephen Meyer, and we have that at Stand to Reason and all kinds of other good things. Check out darwinsdoubt.com for lots of clips and writings, and he's got a lot of good things you can follow up on. Thanks for spending the time with me here at Stand to Reason, and I'm Greg Kokel, and I've just had a pleasure talking with you today. Go out and give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.